Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Ladies and gentlemen, for the month of June, we are in celebration, but in also in acknowledgement of Men Mental Health Month. Mm-hmm. I don't know who dubbed it. I don't know who said it should be a thing. But it is definitely a thing. But part of our chronicles is that we're going to be addressing the elephant in the room, and we're going to be talking about issues, all the issues that we can possibly think of. Now, when we're talking about the Pulling Heartstrings Chronicles, right, it is a question of how will I know, and we as the audience, or we as the spectators, or we as the listeners, or we as the involvees, what we do is now fill in the blanks. So we've asked a series of questions. How will I know if I married the correct person? How will I know if I'm a good parent? How will I know if the job that I'm at is good for me? How will I know? How will I know? How will I know? And for the past 2 days, we were talking about dysfunctional families. So we were talking about, the question was, how will I know if I come from a dysfunctional family or not? And we basically spent the last 2 days talking about dysfunctional families and talking about the characteristics that come with a dysfunctional family in order for you to determine whether or not you come from a dysfunctional family or a functioning family. And I think that when we put ourselves at the forefront of anything, it is imperative to know that we are human beings and we have emotions, we have feelings, we have secrets, we have open-handed secrets. It is dangerous out here to be a human being, but we are living anyways. We're living even though we are in a jungle, even though it's an extreme sport, even though it is not always pleasant, even though beautiful memories are short-lived or beautiful moments are short-lived. We keep going. Right? Like, we soldier on regardless of the fuss that is going on. So, ladies and gentlemen, these questions, right, are the intimate questions that you might have that you can't ask anybody. And even if you asked somebody, they wouldn't quite give you the correct answer, or they wouldn't give you an answer that is filled with as many examples as we could possibly give you. So these are little questions that you hold deep inside your heart. Sometimes the questions are embarrassing. Sometimes the questions are embarrassing. Like, for example, how will I know if I smell or not? Because, it is one of those things where we assume, right, that the next person must know if they smell good or they smell bad. But then what about the person that really doesn't know? What about the person that can't smell themselves? What about the person that can't, like, for the life of me, cannot differentiate between I'm smelling or I'm not smelling? What about that person? Because these people do exist. We are individuals and we come from different places and we have different experiences, and we are also unique in our pleasant and unpleasant ways, and there is no question that is too silly for us to answer. So sometimes, right, if you would like for us to tackle a question, for example, and you feel too shy to call in or too shy to reach out on that kind of level, right? You can always DM us on our Facebook page, and then you can just say, this is for Pulling Heartstrings, and then you just write the question there, and I will definitely get it, and then we might just tackle it. So, ladies and gentlemen, the question for tonight is, how will I know if I am disappointed or I have disappointed others? Now, you might be thinking, yeah, but Matriarch, I mean, come on, everybody knows what disappointment is. Everybody knows, you know, there's nobody in the world that could most probably ever think that they've not disappointed or they've not been disappointed at all. But the thing is that there are a few people that can't differentiate between sadness and disappointment. There are people that can't differentiate between anger and outrage. They can't differentiate between deflecting or being in survival mode, opposed to being upset about something. There are people that can't differentiate, and who are we but sinners as well, right? Who are we to judge anybody? We can't judge anybody. We can't judge anybody for these questions that pop up, right? Because sometimes you really just don't know. Maybe people look at you and they say things about you and you feel like they are not a fan of you, but you can't really ask them because you're scared. You're scared to ask because sometimes you don't want the answer from them. You want the answer from your mother, the matriarch, because she's going to lay it down easy, right? She's going to explain so bad, so deep, so hard that you are going to be in full understanding by the end of our 3-hour session. And there is not going to be, a gray area. It's going to be as clear as day. So maybe we can just start by defining or looking at what the word disappointment in itself is. Okay. Disappointment can manifest various ways, both emotionally and behaviorally. Common signs include a loss of passion and motivation, increased irritability, withdrawal from loved ones, and changes in appetite. Ah. Or sleep patterns, ha. Huh? That is, if you are depressed, I almost said depressed, because these are telltale signs, this one. They're telling us it's disappointment, but it manifests in various ways, both emotionally and behaviorally. Okay, we do understand that, right? Sometimes it is displayed. So when they say it's manifested, right, we say it is displayed. So a more lighter word opposed to manifestation is it's displayed. So we can say that disappointment is displayed in either emotionally or in your behavior. Now, what are the common signs that you, for example, are disappointed? There could be a loss of passion and motivation and increased irritability. You get irritated very quickly, and withdrawal from loved ones, and changes in appetite or sleep patterns. So if somebody is disappointed in you, this is most probably what they are experiencing. There is a loss for passion. Like they're not listening. And they don't seem motivated when it comes to you. So you are the test subject here. When it comes to you and how they handle you in this way. They handle you without passion. They handle you without emotion, motivation. They handle you with a lot of irritability. So the likelihood of you saying something that is very innocent and they blow it out of proportion because everything that you say is irritating them is way high. And then withdrawal from loved ones. If you are disappointed, you withdraw from them. But when people are disappointed in you, there's a tendency to withdraw from you completely. And they might not withdraw physically, and some do withdraw physically, but some withdraw in a sense of if you are talking, for example, if I'm disappointed in you and we're sitting in a living room and you say something and I'm withdrawing from you, you know, it's like, You are unhealthy for me. So I'm keeping myself away from you. I can easily choose to not, be a part of the conversation that you're choosing to have. So everybody can be talking to you and I'm just not talking to you, or I'm not contributing to the conversation. That is also a sense of withdrawal. Or you can ask them questions. This could be somebody that you used to have real conversations with, you know, hours on end. And because of the disappointment, right? They give you short answers. They give you one word answers. They don't have anything to say to you. And that could be withdrawal, right? They withdraw from you. And sometimes if we're talking about withdrawal, somebody that's disappointed from you, and I see this a lot with, teenage pregnancy, right? Parents choose to withdraw from their children financially, where they choose to not they choose to not support their children because their children are busy making children. And in a lot of our black households, right, what is said there is the person that got you pregnant must be the one that supports you financially. And this is a, like, it's a slap in the face because it might have not been intentional. It might have not been planned. It was just something that happened and you also couldn't stop it because you are a baby also and it just happened and there's nothing you can do about it because you're also not a murderer. And now you are left with people that are withdrawing from you because they are disappointed in you. And also this also happens with the teenager's friends, right? They also withdraw from the teenager that's pregnant because they are disappointed in you, like they are disappointed in you. And part of the disappointment with teenagers, right, with their friends is that they are also ashamed. So it's shame and disappointment mixed together. So you become the isolated one because nobody really wants to be in your vicinity. We can be sitting in the living room and you come in and me that's disappointed in you, I just walk out. Or you can be talking about something. You can have valid points and I'll just choose to not participate within the conversation. Or I'll choose to make it seem like your conversation or whatever you're talking about, you have no idea what you are talking about, right? Some of these things happen when someone is disappointed in you, they tend to withdraw from you, right? And changes in appetite and sleep patterns. Now, you might not see this, right? But people that are disappointed in you, they struggle with these things. They struggle with these things because, part of the issue is that they think about you a lot. Now, if I'm thinking about you a lot, you that disappointed me, if I'm thinking about you a lot, when am I sleeping? That means I'm not sleeping as much as I'm supposed to be sleeping. And this happens, sometimes with children that disobey parents or children that are rebellious or children that are living a dangerous life or children that don't listen, right? What happens is that their parents are disappointed in them and their parents tell themselves things like, I'm worried and that is why I'm not sleeping. I'm worried about them and that is why I'm not sleeping. But the question is, if it's really just worry about them, then how come you don't sleep immediately when the person comes back? How come you don't just hit the pillow as soon as you hear that gate opening and you know that they are home safe? Because it's not worry. It is a deep sense of disappointment when you toss and you turn and you are thinking about that person and you're thinking about what they've done and why they have done what they've done and who are they truly within your life. And these are very difficult questions to ask yourself, especially when you love somebody. They're difficult questions to ask yourself and they're also difficult questions to answer. They are difficult to answer because of the mere fact that we love who we love. We love our children. We love our spouses. We love our friends. We love our cousins. We love our family members. We love who we love, right? And then there are certain people that are just absolutely important to you. Now you find people that don't lose sleep over nothing. It's just like the people that don't lose sleep, that don't lose appetite over nothing. I have an aunt, my mother's younger sister, whether she is very sick or not sick, or she's up or she's down or she's wherever, she never, ever, ever loses appetite. Never. Never in the history of her existence has she lost appetite. Even if it is a funeral that is within the house, she must eat. She just doesn't lose appetite. And I don't know now if the food is a coping mechanism or it's a sense of enjoyment. I don't know there, but maybe we'll have to look into it and see if we can dissect that one. But she doesn't lose appetite. Now for you that's disappointed, You will get back into the rhythm of things, but it comes after a while. And in that time, you don't have an appetite to eat. You're not thinking about food, man, because it's like, huh, I just feel so bad, right? You say you feel bad, but the truth is, it's that it's disappointment. You might also experience emotional numbness. Now, what is emotional numbness? Emotional numbness is being, it's almost like being in neutral, where whenever it's time to go left or time to go right or time to go up or time to go down, you can go because you're flexible. But it's like having a sense of nothing. You feel nothing. Like it's just, even if somebody walks past there, or the person that disappointed you walk past there and get bumped by a guy, you might not feel anything, maybe, but you might have an emotional numbness where you just, that's next me. You feel nothing. Unexplained fatigue, that sleep that you're sleeping. And the disappointment, right? The signs of disappointment, they sound more and more like depression. But I think that it is from something as deep as disappointment. I believe that it can birth depression, because everything that is happening here within the disappointment sphere is something that has the ability to gravitate towards depression. Because when you're fatigued, is you just, she's not late, she will slap. I don't know. Also, I've been chilling with a lot of people that speak Afrikaans these days. Now I'm all of a sudden just, she's not lying. So, you're fatigued. You want to sleep, man. You want to sleep and you just, So these are part of the experiences, and a general sense of apathy or sadness. So you just have this general sense of you are just not okay. You're not happy. You might be sad, and it's not even because of what's happening at work or what's happening in your relationship. It's most probably just what's happening with the person that's disappointed, or that disappointed you. And it would also be difficult, especially if we mask our emotions and we don't understand our emotions fully. Sometimes we say it is anger, right? And when we say it's anger like that, we continue living like it is anger, but it's not really anger. And this is now where you can start feeling sadness. And then when somebody asks you, like, are you okay? And then you're like, oh, I'm just so angry. But it's not anger. It's sadness, okay? In some cases, a disappointment can lead to physical symptoms like headaches or gastric issues. Because our stomach is linked to many, many, many areas of our body, and we don't even really know it. Because you can feel sad, right? And then your whole stomach just starts paining. You can feel stress, and then you can just get diarrhea. You can feel anxiety, and then you can also vomit. You can feel tension, and then you can feel nausea and dizzy spells. So all of that has to do with your stomach as well. So before we dive into that, we're going to dive into a TED Talk that is talking about how to talk the worst parts of yourselves. How to talk to the worst parts of yourself. Now, this is for self-disappointment, right? Sometimes, ladies and gentlemen, we are disappointed in ourselves, for our actions and for the lack of action even, or for our misdemeanors and our tragedies, you know. Sometimes we are so disappointed within ourselves, but we don't know how to face it. We don't know if it's even a thing, and we don't know nothing. We call it regret. Many of us call it regret. Many of us call it self-doubt. We call it self something, but many of us don't really talk about self-disappointment. What happens when you are disappointed in yourself? What happens when you betrayed yourself? What happens when you are the villain in your story, and there's nobody that's going to come and be the villain in your story, because you've already occupied that seat? And how do you live with yourself then? And we're gonna listen, you know, how are we gonna talk to the worst parts of ourselves? Because The reason that we don't like ourselves very much is that we know ourselves. And you know somebody out there that is so bad and you don't want to be associated to them. But now imagine you calculating every single thing that you have ever done wrong to harm yourself, to harm others, to harm society, to harm somebody's job. Everything that you have done, you know, broken somebody's heart, everything that you have done, your body keeps count. Your body keeps score, right? So you live with this. And even though we box these emotions away and we box these memories away and experiences away, the only one that doesn't forget is your body. Your body doesn't forget that once upon a time you betrayed your friend. Once upon a time you stabbed your friend. Once upon a time you disrespected your mother. Once upon a time you cheated on a test. Once upon a time, your body doesn't forget this because it is these are permanent details within your DNA, right? But you know all these things about yourself. And one day you wake up and then you're like, I'm so disappointed in myself. How could I be this person? I'm just not meant to be this person. And sometimes, right, this disappointment can drive us over the edge, but hopefully for us, or luckily for us, we've got Eagle FM and we're going to go through the issues together and come out victorious on the other side.
It isn't true what they say, that you can't love anyone until you love yourself. Have you heard that? Some people say you have to learn to love yourself before you can love anybody else. But it's not true. I loved everybody before I loved myself. Love doesn't care which way you come or what state you're in when you get here. Love welcomes everyone unconditionally. Oddly, so do focus group moderators. Which is how and why I learned to do it. If you've never been a part of a focus group, you're missing a really special cultural experience. So in every focus group, there's a range of characters, right? There's always a shy one and a chatty one, a grumpy one that doesn't want to do any of the exercises, and a very excited mom with a notebook who wants to get an A+ in all of the exercises. There's a student who lied on the intake because they need the money, and a dad full of jokes who can't read the room. And usually there's one ex-military guy who keeps staring at the two-way mirror suspiciously. It's a situation where a group of people that may not otherwise ever meet have the chance to share their perspectives. And it's my job as the moderator to make sure that they all get heard. Now, it's not quite a classroom. It's not group therapy, and while the community feel has some elements of holiness, probably no one would call it a spiritual experience. I mean, no one else. Because moderating rooms of strange and difficult voices is what taught me to welcome all the strange and difficult parts of myself. No kidding. I start every morning meditation with the same opener I use as a focus group moderator. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Your input is valued. I'm going to hear from each of you. I'll give you all the chance to speak. Just do your best to be completely present, honest, and try to make any requests reasonable. So, I don't know about you, but there are a lot of me in here, in the mind of Karen Faith. I'm not referring to psychiatric illness specifically, but I don't exclude that. My mind has plenty of quirks, but what I have to share is for anyone with an inner dialogue, though I admit it's especially for those of us with a really noisy one. So I noticed some time ago that I was arguing with myself, and then I wondered, if I didn't agree with me, who is I and who is me in that scenario? And it turned out that there are quite a few of me. There's a really sentimental, emotional me, and an intellectual, analytical me. Those two argue a lot. There's a me who loves being on stage. Here's another one who's pretty shaky at the moment. Some of us, at this time I include you, some of us regard these as feelings or thoughts, and maybe we've done our personal homework accepting that we can have conflicting feelings at the same time. We can be excited about a new job and also dread going back to work. We can be tired and want to stay up. We can adore someone who also annoys us. We can love someone who has badly betrayed us. We know this. And when we're honest and rational, we can see that these are common experiences, that we're not crazy to both love and hate camping. It does me no harm to embrace that I feel both ways about it. But what about the thought that I'm worthless, that I don't belong here, that the mistakes I've made are unforgivable, that the bad things that happened in my life were my fault? Those thoughts are just as real as the rest of them, but they're harder to live with. And they send many of us to therapy or to yoga or the nearest bar, which more or less describes my daily commute for many years. Because I wanted to silence those thoughts completely. And let me tell you, I tried. I have done every kind of therapy I have ever heard of. I have done talk therapy, energy healing, body work, hypnotherapy, soul retrieval, the tapping stuff, the thing with the lights. I did 7 kinds of yoga. I drank the special tea with the shaman in the forest. I admit I did pass on the acupuncture they do with live honeybees. But people do that. Suffice to say, I tried. And still sometimes when I was alone, I would hear myself shouting, "Shut up," or worse, to my own mind. In my work as a people researcher, it's my job to practice empathy with strangers, to receive everything I can about their world in order to understand them as deeply as possible. Now, it's noteworthy that I found this career at a temp job writing meeting notes when my supervisor noticed that I wasn't just paraphrasing conversation, I was recording body language, microexpressions, tonal shifts, specific verb choices. What neither of us knew then is that the qualities which made me seem skillful were the symptoms of complex post-traumatic stress, the most reasonable results of an appalling upbringing, and a fact I share not to set me apart from you, but to welcome you in here with me. Everyone in this room has walked through something difficult in order to be here. And I want you to know that whatever path you've taken to get through it is honorable. Whether you never talk about it, whether you write bad poetry about it, whether you make tons of money prosecuting it, or if you just hit the gym like a champ to sweat it out of your body, there is truly no wrong way. There are some ways that cause other problems. You know the ones. I've done some of those. I still do some of those. And I don't judge those either. Because gifts and curses are buy one, get one. And mine were no exception. My early life gave me heaps of shame and a splintered sense of self, hence all the different me's. But it also gave me super antennas for the emotions of others. This hypervigilance made me a certified mess of a person, but a damn near wizard-level observer. So I got to work. In the last 20 years, I've shadowed people in their homes, at their jobs, while they shop and drive and go on dates. I ask them to be honest and vulnerable with me. And to do this, I practice something that I call unconditional welcome, which is like a researcher's neutrality, but a little extra. The day I discovered it, I was sitting in the living room of a research subject. She was a very unpleasant woman, if I'm honest, feeding French fries to an infant as she snapped at me that she would never have her children vaccinated, not even to protect them from polio, because she didn't know what was in those shots. Now, never mind that she said this an inch of ash deep into a Virginia Slim, right? I was judging her. I know. I'm not proud of it, but at least one of me is a jerk. I needed to connect with her, and I didn't want to. I didn't like her. I didn't respect her. I didn't want to spend a single moment with her, and the project required that I spend hours and that I use that time to get to know her, what she values, what she believes, where she finds strength. Researcher neutrality was unavailable to me at the time, so I had to get out the big guns. I called up my new age visualization skills, and I took a deep breath, secondhand smoke and all, and I imagined that my breath was inflating a shiny soap bubble filled with unconditional welcome. Not tolerance, not even compassion, total welcome, as is, no comments, no notes. And as I inflated the bubble, it became big enough to contain my whole body, and then hers. And in that moment, I saw a mother feeding her baby in a world that she didn't trust. I told her that I could see that she cared about protecting her son, and I asked her if she got that from her parents. And then we had a conversation, and I learned about her. I learned why she was afraid and angry, and how she fought through that fear to make a family. When I welcomed this woman unconditionally, I saw her more clearly, but I also loved her instantly. We have been told too often that love is hard. It's not. Love is what happens when we stop trying to figure out who deserves it. It's right there. When we stop trying to figure out who deserves it and we welcome someone, anyone, exactly as they are in the moment. It will be 2 more years before I learn to do this with all the parts of myself. But it started just as simply. A part of me had become very chatty. A part that was afraid and angry. Whiny, demanding, unreasonable, and relentless. She told me that we were never going to get better, and she wanted out of here. I asked her what I could do. She only told me she wanted to die over and over and over and over. I begged her to shut up, and she did not. Finally, after weeks of harassment, whether out of exhaustion or epiphany, instead of shouting back, I took a deep breath. I became my own moderator. I said out loud in a voice that surprised me, "Thank you for sharing. I'm going to remind you of our agreement to be honest and reasonable." And she answered me, that voice. Now, don't get spooked. This is all just thinking happening. But the part of me asking and the part answering did in fact seem like different parts. She told me that she was in a lot of pain, and I told her, "I know. And I promise you, I'm going to take care of you, but I need you to get on board. I will listen to you, but I will not obey you." And as clearly as I'm speaking to you now, she said, "Okay." And then we started to talk. As I continued the dialogue with myself, I found more of me, more voices with more points of view, some of them more fun than others. And the imagined landscape of my mind began to look a lot like a focus group, this round table of wildly mixed characters, and one moderator keeping some kind of order with honesty, boundaries, kindness, and most importantly, gratitude. I thank myself for their contributions, no matter how bonkers or twisted they may seem, because we're all me. I think of my fragmented self less like a broken mirror and more like a prism. We're a full spectrum. Today, there isn't a voice in my head that I don't welcome, and while some of us are occasionally unreasonable, we're not mean. Even my whiny, shamey voice is trying to help in her weird way. But when I ask her to be clear and kind, she tells me exactly what I need to know, what she needs to feel better, and what she'd like for me to learn. But just like the scared and angry mother, she only does this when I accept her exactly as she is in the moment. So while my openings for self-talk and focus groups sound almost identical, the closings are a little different. At the round table, I would hand out parking validation and remind everyone to sign for their cash. But when I'm with all of me, I say, "I love you. Thank you for helping me see what you see," which is why this practice is so useful for all of us here with our different perspectives, inside and outside of one another. If we can receive one another with the curiosity and welcome of a focus group moderator, perhaps we can do a better job of love. Because it is not true what they say, that you can't love anyone until you love yourself. Love is a house you can crawl in through a window. If you can't start with yourself, start with the person next to you right now, whether you know them or not. All you have to do is let them be here. It's easy, isn't it? Wherever they've been, whatever they're carrying, whatever talents they have or don't have, whatever mistakes they've made, can you just welcome them here? Can you welcome you? We're here right now like this. We're beautiful and strange and complicated and scared and sometimes kind of horrible. But all of us are worthy of welcome. And everyone that you show unconditional welcome may show you a part of yourself to love. You are welcome. Thank you.
You are welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening to you. We are talking about disappointment. We're asking the question of, am I a disappointment? Or did I disappoint myself? We're asking these questions. And in order for us to understand these questions, we have to dive deeper into the sense of self and the sense of disappointment in order for us to understand it and to pinpoint and to place ourselves. So we spoke about disappointment and its definition. Disappointment is said to be a manifestation. It's said to be something that manifests itself in two ways, emotionally or behaviorally, with common signs that include the loss of passion, motivation, increased irritability, withdrawal from loved ones or loved ones withdrawing from you, and changes in appetite and sleeping habits. You might be experiencing emotional numbness, unexplained fatigue, and a general sense of apathy or sadness. In some cases, disappointment can lead to physical symptoms like headaches and gastric and stress. So let's go into it. The loss of passion and interest. So you're thinking like, matriarch, right now in my life, I'm just so disappointed. I'm disappointed in the world. I'm disappointed in the country. I'm disappointed in Mene Tumbo's administration. I'm disappointed in Swartboy's words. I'm disappointed in Linda's life. Hey, it's hectic. I'm disappointed, right? So how do you know then? I don't know, matriarch. Let's go through it. So the loss of passion and interest, things that once excited you may no longer hold the same volume or the same oomph. Now, this happens to us a lot. I'm a firm believer in change. I'm a firm believer in growth. So I do believe that sometimes we shed. Sometimes we let go of things that no longer serve us, or they don't serve us in this lifetime, or they don't serve us in this time or season in our lives, such as you used to love painting back then and now you don't paint anymore. But I believe that, I believe. Okay. But I do believe that, some things you leave gradually, right? You leave gradually. You can't just decide that you're never going to do that again. You can't just decide without warning. You can't not prepare for something and then you just have no interest in it. Not unless something bad has happened. So this is what we're talking about, the passion and the interest. So if you are no longer passionate about painting, you're no longer passionate about orphans, you're no longer passionate about street people, the question could be, what happened to you? What happened to you? I don't know what happened to me. Are you sure? Are you sure you're not disappointed in someone or yourself? And moving on to irritability, increased irritability. You are easy to irritate. And this one is something that we might not see because we think we're absolutely fine. Or we can say that we are always angry. Have you ever been called always angry? Somebody says that you're always angry. No matter what happens, you're always angry, matriarch. But you weren't like that. You were not born like that. It's not that this is who you are or you've always been like that. It's something that has happened and now it's causing you irritation. Now this irritation may seem like anger. It may seem like frustration. It may seem like rage or outrage. It may seem as if you're stressed. Right? But it is irritation. Everything irritates you. It's like a thing that is touching your skin the whole time and you don't want it. You might find yourself easily frustrated and angered by small inconveniences, right? Whereas on an ordinary day, you wouldn't be angry about something that is so small like that. You wouldn't be frustrated about something that is so menial like that. It wouldn't be something that bothers you. But yet, all of a sudden, you have become the chica that is just irritated about everything. Like, I just don't know, I can't do this. Like, don't look at me like that. Don't talk to me like that. So emotional numbness, number three, emotional numbness. You may feel detached or unable to experience emotions and as strongly before. So all of the sudden, right? You used to cry when you watch movies and now you just don't cry anymore. You used to feel bad when something bad happens to other people and you don't feel bad anymore. You used to feel bad when somebody does something bad to you and now you don't feel it anymore, right? This could also be a sign of disappointment. You could be disappointed in mankind. You could be disappointed in humanity. We don't know, but it's definitely something worth looking into because it said that you are numb, but these are all signs so that you must look for them. So say now you're trying to see if your father is disappointed in you or not. You ask or you notice, right? Your dad used to like fixing that car every Saturday and now he could care less. Like really honestly, he could care less about whatever, like, he just doesn't have interest anymore. And he's there, but he's not there. It's like he's detached from you guys. He's there, but he's not there. And you guys must just come up, be strong. And number four is sadness and apathy. A general feeling of a dejection. Or lack of motivation can be a sign of disappointment. So you feel like sad, but it's like a sadness that just, like that. Okay. Then we move on to number five, which I feel is important. Feelings of regret or remorse. Like, why did I do that? You know? How could I do that? How could I do that? Why did I do that? Oh my goodness. How could this, like, oh my goodness. How could I allow? Now, if you are in the seat where you are disappointed by somebody, there is a shift that happens. There's one day that you're going to blame yourself for whatever has happened to you. And I know that we all know that we shouldn't blame ourselves, right? But we do. And that is why we find regret. I regret meeting that person in my life. I regret going to that school. I regret working there. I regret, right? And then you find remorse, which are, I wish I had never, like, you know, I wish I had never gone there. Like, oh my goodness. You might dwell on past events and wish you had, acted differently. Like, have you ever been in a fight, right? Or somebody said something to you and they got the last word. Usually when you go home, you go and think about what happened and then you say things like, I should hear when the person said that, then I should have said that, then I should have said that, then I should have said that. And that is now what happens to many of us in cases of disappointment because we are disappointed in ourselves most for our behavior. Sometimes maybe you ran away from a fight and then you are like, oh, but I could have taken that person. I could have just bumped them. I could have just kicked them. I could have just what? And the moment has passed and now you just living in this moment and it's not nice because you have so much regret of not doing something, right? And the last one is now, you know, withdrawal from loved ones. Sometimes we explained this, right? But disappointment can lead to isolation or, and a desire to avoid societal interactions or avoid people within any social community thingy. So this is, I feel like this is also associated, roughly to shame, because if you didn't really have shame, then you can just do that. But also you can also just be laying in bed and not wanting to do anything. What? So ever. All right. So ladies and gentlemen,
great news! Impact just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Impact? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past. Mm. And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager...
A clicker. I'm so bad with this. Watch me destroy it. Yep. It's so easy for me, right? Because everything that goes wrong, I just go, oh no, it's paranormal. Right? Because, oh my God, really? When you wake up in the morning, you brush your teeth, you look in the mirror, what do you see? Paranormal, right? Really? You know, like my tagline, you know, what we see may not be real, and what is real, we may not see. And that is actually very much the truth. Okay, so, I was flattered and I was, honored when Tara and her team invited me to be a speaker this afternoon. And then I said, oh yeah, TEDx, okay, TEDx, fine. And then they added the youth, and I'm like, youth, easy. I'm thinking to myself, I was a youth so long ago. Watching the other speakers, right, I was telling myself, oh my God, they should just archive me under archives, you know? So anyways, all right, so you heard a little bit about me. Yes, I many things are used to describe me. And being 47, I have heard a lot. We have the B word. We have the C word, C for crazy. All right, and then all kinds of words. I am a lot of things. I'm a publisher recently. I've been a publisher since 2009, and I decided to make myself an author this year, so I wrote a book. And 4 years ago, I decided I shall be a TV host, so I hosted a program. And then I can't go and host fashion program, slimming program, which I need, facelift program, which I definitely need, all kinds of but no, I have to go and do the paranormal zone. It is because I was inspired by my guru, my spiritual teacher, who says that we are always afraid. We're afraid of the bills. We're afraid of a lot of things. We're afraid of if you're a mother, you're afraid if your kids are going to pass. If you're married, you're afraid if your partner is going to cheat on you. You're just afraid. So why are we going to be afraid of what we cannot see anyways, right? So that's why I was inspired to give people information about the paranormal, okay? So that was just a little bit about me. Okay, now, when I was your age a long time ago, with slight amnesia kicking in and Alzheimer and all kinds of stuff kicking in, I don't really remember. We're talking about 30 years ago. Yeah, No more. Oh God. All right. So anyways, forget about how old I am. I wish someone had told me my what's next. And if you look at the array of things that I have done with my life, what's next is constant. Even right now, what's next, what's next, what's next. But I wish someone had spent time to tell me that what's next is going to happen anyways. Whether you like it or not, your parents paid fees, you're here, you've got to get a job. Whether you like it or not, everyone's obsessed with love and a relationship, so you're going to be in a relationship, right? So the what's next is more or less carved up. And if you're going to be in a relationship, you're going to end up being somebody's wife or somebody's husband. If you're going to be somebody's husband, somebody's wife, you're going to end up being a father and mother and da 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 da. So I'm not going to tell you what you should do with your life, but I'm going to tell you how to live your life. There's so much I have learned in 47 years, but I want to talk to you about managing disappointment. It's always going to be fun, but it's always also going to be not so fun. So I went to school a long time ago. I graduated. Many teachers went through my life, and there were a few things I remembered. And the clicker is not what I learned in school. Hi, I'm Lee Kim. We've done that already. Right. Uncertainty is the only certainty, guys. All right? You're going to go out there and you are certain you're going to get a job. And you are certain you're going to fall in love. Okay? But guess what? You may not. That's why politicians talk about unemployment. And you will get a job and you'll be certain that it's the best job on the planet. You're going to make your millions. You're going to be the next Bill Gates. Guess what? Maybe not. You're going to fall in love. You're going to find that perfect guy, perfect girl. Oh my God, there is a God. And that's it, right? You're in love. Cloud 9, cloud 99, 69, whatever 9. All right? And guess what? Guess what? 9 days later, 9 weeks later, 9 months later, 9 years later, you're no longer in love. Because the certainty of love is uncertain. Now, why do I bring this up? Do I want to dampen your future and tell you there's no what's next? Do I want to tell you what's next sucks? Okay, guess what? It will suck. So, and one of the sucky things that's going to happen, guys, is you will feel disappointed. You will be disappointed in a lot of things. And you need to manage that. You need to handle that. And you need to know you can overcome that. Because why? Even in your disappointment, my next quote. Seriously? You want me to take on the mother thing and give you a sermon about how to get this right? Right. See? Even in your disappointment and despair, and completely upset, and you're like, oh my God, let me just go on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and tell them how I feel, and you sound so pathetic. Okay? And you are such a victim of the world. Guess what? Even in your disappointment and your worst moments, feeling really down, it is not permanent. Because the one permanence is impermanence. Life is impermanent. None of you in this room can tell me with certainty and permanently you're going to stay alive. Right? We are all going to one day expire, drop dead, die. But we don't focus on dying. We focus on now. We focus on living. And that is why I say we manage disappointment. People will come, people will go. Things will happen in your life. You will experience failure, which is the best thing. It is the secret key ingredient to success. So don't be all hung up over failure, okay? Someone's going to come and hurt you. You'll be disappointed in your friends, your family, your teachers, your parents, the world, Facebook, Instagram. I don't know. I have to go onto social media. I have to use my phone a lot because my kids do. Nobody's talking to me. Okay, that's my permanent situation, but never mind. I shall make that impermanent because they're going to grow out of it too. So you're going to face it. Like it or not, you will face disappointment. People are going to come into your life. Things are going to happen. It's not going to be according to your little perfect box. What I'm trying to say is, don't live fixated. Don't live attached to the way something should be. Don't live with the attachment of how everyone should be. Don't put things and people in boxes. Because boxes are restrictive. They're not open to growth. Boxes contain. They don't liberate. It's not free. It's not open. Once you accept that uncertainty is the one certainty, once you accept that the one permanence is impermanence, you will let things go. You won't get obsessed with things, especially. I mean, being obsessed with the good things is fine. Okay? It's fine. Be focused. But if you're obsessed about things that how it should be, and when it doesn't, you break. How many times can you break? You're not a cat. You don't have 9 lives. How many times can you be disappointed and not get over it? How many times can you tell yourself, oh my God, I'm so sad. This person is such a person. How can you just do thing to me? I mean, this is TEDx youth, right? Okay, so I got a lot of things I can't say. Over 30 years, you develop a lot of vocabulary. Okay, so over 47 years, actually. I just discounted 17 years. But anyways, so what I'm trying to say, guys, girls, in case I'm called a sexist. I am a sexist, by the way. So what? I love male and female. Because you know why? I'm human, just like what Michelle said. Okay, so you will. Whether you like it or not. Whether you're prepared or not, you will be disappointed. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing depressing about that. Just like failure. If you get over your disappointment, you come out stronger, you come out more prepared for the next disappointment. And in between your disappointments, you will enjoy life. Okay? Trust me. Okay? Come and see me when you're 47. I should be dead. But you can call on, you know, play with Ouija board. Call my name. I'll be there. Okay? All right? When you're 47, yeah? When you're 47 and you have an opportunity to get up here, you'll be talking about that. You're going to succeed, guys. You're going to do what you want to do. And you will be happy doing it, I assure you. But you will hit moments of disappointment. And you need to tell yourself, hey, uncertainty is the one certainty and the one permanence is impermanence. So even when you're down and upset, hurt, and in pain, it's impermanent. It will pass. Similarly, when you're ecstatic, happy, at a high, successful, it will always also not last. So constant endeavor to keep living. Every disappointment shouldn't stop you, nor every success should stop you from progress. Okay? So, unless you are planning to... Am I the only one that has this problem? I told you I was special. I always told you that. I always knew I was special. Like, special. Right. Okay. Conflict like taxation and debt is inevitable. Which one of you, raise your hands if you're planning to crawl into a hole and live alone? Anyone? No. Do you think at any point in your next decades of your life that the world will stop having human beings? You hope, right? You wish. Work on it. That could be your what's next. Okay. Now, as long as we are going to be interacting with human beings, this is very much linked with what Michelle was earlier saying. You will have conflict. Why? Because we all have egos. Very big. We nurture our egos so that we are right. We want to be right. We desire to be right. Being right is everything. When was the last time you endorsed and made sure you were right and the person you were facing had tears in their eyes? When was the last time? Correct. So is your mission in life to make someone cry? Is your mission in life to hurt someone? Nowadays, you don't do it in person. You do it over social media. That's real chicken, by the way. You got an issue, pick them up, face it. No. Oh my God. Ayo. Cannot tahan, really cannot tahan. Oh, then piss off. really? Seriously? And then you have 100 likes. Yes. Yeah. All right, what was I saying? Even my thoughts was impermanent for a second. Okay, so as long as you live with people, you will have conflict. Because why? Our egos are so big and our desires to be right is so strong. Let me ask you, and you think about this. It is not necessary to be right. It's not. I'm not saying live your life to be wrong. That's not what I'm saying. But it's not necessary to be right at the expense of another person's ideas, another person's differing opinions, another person's different belief. It's not worth it. Differing opinions and differing beliefs is perfect grounds for learning and to be better people. So, the next time someone has something different than your opinion, Anjong, come. What did you just say? Really? The next time someone says something, it's not aligned to your perfect little box. Chill. Chill. The moment may not be permanent. Just chill and say, okay, take a step back. Okay. Why is that? Can I hear what do you mean by that? And let that person express their differing opinion, which may sound differing in the beginning, but at the end of it, it may be the same goal as yours, just a different method. So instead of riding on your ego righteous horse, which is actually a donkey, wanting to be right and not hearing what others want to say, you create conflict. There is enough conflict in this world on its own. You don't need to add to it. You need to be human. You need to practice humane behavior. Okay? Another way of, an example of managing conflict. Put away your ego. You know, in the morning, wake up. Put your ego in the toilet. Okay? Get dressed. Go to college. Go to wherever you need to go. The next time someone comes to you and you are like looking forward to this amazing meeting and this person just seems agitated. Number one, don't take it personally. It may have nothing to do with you. Take a step back. Don't be righteous about what it should be and how this person should behave because you say so. And just say, hey, can I offer you a cup of coffee, tea? You seem a little bit, you know, agitated. Is there anything I can do? Break the ice by being kind. Don't just start talking to yourself, you know, wow, what's wrong with this person? They think they're so powerful, is it? Just because older than me, talk like my mother, is it? You know, don't have that. Don't start creating thoughts that's going to make you blurt out words that's going to create conflict. So, wow, 2 minutes left. Yes, see? Even 18 minutes is not permanent. Right. Okay, so how do I get along life, yeah? 47 years, I've not been arrested for killing anybody. Trust me, I've had those thoughts. Like I want to kill this thing right now. Seriously. Is this a test of my mega... Alright. Okay. Yeah, you see, not only do I have to host the Paranormal Zone, now I gotta do an imitation of Darth Vader gone wrong. Right, compassion. People are like, oh, you're compassionate. So people think I'm stupid. No. Compassion is not about being soft. Compassion is not about being a doormat. Compassion, if you put everything, is very deep. I like to put it as being kind, being generous, being wise, and being considerate. Why do I say that? Be kind in your thoughts. Be generous with your intentions. Be wise in your experience and be considerate in your actions. That's compassion. Okay? Compassion takes you a long way. I'm practicing a lot of compassion right now. Humility. Do you not hate those people who are very successful? They made it. They got it. They got everything. Ferrari, Lotus, Nasi Kandar, whatever, yeah? And they're so pompous. They walk like they had implants. Even a man. With the chest so high up, the nose sticking in the air as though, you know what, I don't know. Okay? And they talk you down. How many of you got people like that in your lives or you have met them? Do you hate them? Aren't they annoying? Because when you're successful, like really successful and not fake successful, do you need to show off? Your success speaks for itself. Humility is a very, very, very sexy and attractive virtue. Be humble. Because guess what? Because everything is impermanent, so will be your success. And one day when you fall flat on your face, oops, people will be like, eh, serve you right, nay, 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 right? So be humble. Why? With time, it's the way to be, and it's very sexy. All right, so now we have, okay, guys, the last one, gratitude. Be grateful of who you are. Be grateful of the people who have contributed to who you are. Be grateful to where you are. And be grateful to the people and situations that have brought you this far. Don't be an ingrate. Don't be ungrateful. Don't bite the hand that feeds you. Most importantly, be grateful to the person who has hurt you. Be grateful to the person who has betrayed you. Be grateful to the person who has disappointed you. Be grateful to the person who stole from you. Why? They are your best teachers. They made you strong. That's if you manage your disappointment. All right? So what's next for you is to walk away with what I have shared. Live compassionately. Live with humility. Live with gratitude. On that note, have a great what's next and have a great future.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Have a great future. So they say that we have to give gratitude. We have to be thankful. We have to be grateful for everything. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, the number in studio is 0832-888-401. That is the number in studio. In case you would like to call us up, in case you would like to participate in our conversation, or maybe you're just having one of those chilled Fridays where you just want to take it all in and you just want to hear what I go and listen to in order for us to create this kind of conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about disappointment. We're talking about what it is. We're talking about how it feels. We're talking about how we can most probably, right, curb it to the sidewalk and then walk away from it. Ladies and gentlemen, when I think about disappointment, when I think about betrayal, when I think about hurt from other people and from ourselves, because we often do betray ourselves, we often do sell ourselves short, and we do throw ourselves under the bus ever so constantly. When I think about disappointment, ladies and gentlemen, I can't help but think that maybe we as human beings, right, we get disappointed because we have so many expectations. I believe that if we lowered the bar on expectations, if we put that all the way down and we expect nothing from nobody, right, not even loyalty, not even love, not even financial aid, nothing. We expect nothing from nobody. Maybe when things happen, the impact of negative things will not be as big as those with expectations tied to it or chained to it. Maybe if we learned to not expect so much from mere human mortals, right, then maybe we wouldn't be so disappointed. I believe that somewhere, somehow, within our make, we are flawed as people because we do expect. We expect. And many of us don't want to admit to terms like entitlement and terms like selfish and greedy and terms like you think the world revolves around you. Many of us don't want to actually admit to such words and such behaviors because we hold ourselves on these pedestals of righteousness and virtue that we don't want to be associated to things that we classify as bad. But in all honesty, when we are up there, right, we we have so many expectations of the world. If we didn't have expectations, right, we wouldn't be disappointed. We wouldn't be angry. We would, there would be nothing that is happening to us at all. You just go about your day and it is what it is. Whether somebody is yelling or somebody's not yelling, whether somebody is betraying or somebody's not betraying, things only hurt when they are close to you. Because you wouldn't think that, you wouldn't think that the guy that you're sharing a ride with, and the car breaks down and then a car comes up and he pushes you out of the way to go and jump into that next car that's coming so that he can go. You wouldn't think of betrayal when it comes to that person. You wouldn't think that this, oh my goodness, I don't understand why that stranger betrayed me like that. You wouldn't think like that because they don't matter. They don't matter. And they are not significant in your life. And the only people that have the capability of disappointing us, of making us feel bad, are people that mean something to us. And yes, it's not fair for people to disappoint us. It's not fair for people to do us dirty, you know? But maybe we have orunyara to play within these expectations that we have put on other people. If we take away these expectations, ladies and gentlemen, I think that we would live a more happy life. We would live a more calm life. We would live a more meh life, you know, when it comes to other people and to ourselves, because we betray ourselves all the time. But yet we forgive ourselves, but we can't forgive other people. Do we really forgive ourselves, or do we just live with ourselves because we can't live with anybody else? I don't know. And that's why we are diving into the psyche of human beings and really just taking in these conversations that people around the world have spoken about on our topics. Ladies and gentlemen, we as Eagle Media House take no ownership. We don't take ownership of any of the information that we share here with you. This is strictly for illustration purposes and for information sharing.
I remember being shocked the first few times I went to Africa. I was shocked when I met a one-legged taxi driver in Kenya. I was shocked when I met Sonia, an orphan schoolgirl in Rwanda. And I was shocked when I met a disabled subsistence farmer in Mozambique. What shocked me wasn't their poverty, but their happiness. I found their happiness confronting, far more confronting than poverty. Of course, not everyone was happy, but of those above a basic subsistence threshold level, I was surprised at how genuinely content many of them were. And I became fascinated in this notion, this idea of happiness. And since then, I've researched it, I've worked on it, I've thought about it. I'm interested in it from an economics perspective. It's one of the things that I research at Oxford. And I'm interested in it from a social enterprise perspective, because happiness is, after all, the ultimate social outcome. And I think it's particularly appropriate that we talk about happiness today, because we have with us the Prime Minister of Bhutan, the very man who pioneered, who introduced, and who championed the idea of gross domestic happiness rather than GDP as a way of tracking countries' progress, as a way of monitoring how governments are doing. But before we go into that, I want to begin with a little quiz, a little game. It's just a simple multiple choice quiz, and I've invited some other participants to join us on stage. So I want you to just raise your hand. I want you to answer honestly when I give the questions. So the first question, imagine that you're competing in the Olympic Games. Imagine that you're representing your country. What would you prefer out of the following? Would you prefer to come second, to come third, or to come second last? Answer honestly. Who would prefer to come second? Raise your hand. Excellent. Who would prefer to come third? And who would prefer to come second last? Excellent. Well, it seems like a large chunk of the audience wants to come second last. I'm not sure that I'd be selecting you for my Olympic team, but the monkeys, they select a third A third, a third. They don't quite understand the question, but they knew that there were three options. It's probably no surprise that amongst the general population, most prefer second. So that's question one. Question number two. Imagine that you're given one of two options. Either you win the lottery and you get $10 million tomorrow, you can spend it however you want. Or option B, alternatively, you get a very small payment tomorrow, but you get gradual payments throughout your lifetime, increasing payments. And in total, you get $8 million over the course of your lifetime. If I gave you that option right now, what would you pick? Who would pick option A? A lot of people. Who would pick option B? Excellent. Amongst the general population, most people seem to be quite short-sighted. Most people like the $10 million tomorrow. Again, the monkeys, 50-50. They did recognize there were two options, not three. Third and final question. You get to choose your salary. What'd you pick? You get $50,000 and everyone else you know gets $50,000. You get $50,000 and everyone else gets $60,000. Or you get $40,000 and everyone else you know gets $30,000. Who would pick option A? Who would pick option B? Virtually no one. Who would pick option C? I think there's one person in an audience of about 200. You're pretty consistent with the general population. Most go for option A, the monkeys, no surprises there. But let's now think about what the actual answers are. Let's look at what the research says about what actually makes us content, what actually makes us satisfied, what actually makes us happy. For question one, the answer is actually to come third, which I think was the lowest of the three options that you all gave. There's no shortage of silver medalists who appear unhappy. So that was question one. Question two, I think you did better on. You picked option B, you went against the general population, and I think you beat the monkeys on this occasion. They beat you on question one, you won question two. And for question three, the correct answer was actually C, which I think only one person got correct. And so the monkeys beat you on two out of three on those, in terms of what actually makes us content, satisfied, and happy, as the research has shown. So I think it's fair to say that, in general, you're slightly better predictors of happiness than the general population, but you're still pretty pathetic, I'm sorry to say. I think the monkeys beat you. Maybe that's why they're smiling, but if they won two out of three. And what's interesting is that it's not only us that's bad predictors of happiness. The macro data actually supports this as well. We're wealthier than ever, but unhappier than ever. We're more prosperous, but more depressed. We're less satisfied. I mean, we have faster and faster transport, but we're faster and faster to complain about it. In many countries, there are now more suicides than homicides. We now have more goods and services than ever before. We have technology improving exponentially, but we don't see a corresponding increase in our life satisfaction, in our happiness. That's perhaps one of the great paradoxes of our time. And I think the obvious question is, why is it that governments and individuals are such bad predictors of happiness? Why is it that we get it wrong so often? And I think it's because we don't really understand why it is that we're often unhappy. And so the obvious question is, why is it that we're unhappy? What's the explanation? Now, it's not an easy question to answer, but it's one that I've thought about, that I've researched, that I've delved into. And through my research over the years, through thinking about it, I think there's one explanation that I find far more compelling, far more plausible, far more persuasive than any other. And that explanation isn't that we have so much choice that we get stressed. It's not that we're economically worse off. In many cases, we're economically better off. It's not that we just have greater reporting of depression and suicide. That's true, but it only explains a small portion of the data. It's not due to family breakdowns or reduced freedoms. No, the reason why we're unhappy, the most compelling reason, as shown by the data, as shown by research, relates to expectations. At a very basic, simple level, we're unhappy when our expectations of reality exceed our experiences of reality, when our expectations exceed reality. And I like to call this an expectation gap, when our expectations are greater than reality. It's a very simple concept, but it's a hugely important concept to fully understand, to fully get our head around. And to help us get our head around it, I like to think in terms of three different types of expectation gaps. Three different types of gaps based on the different ways in which we form expectations. I think we form expectations based on our imagination, based on those around us, and based on our past experiences. So to this first type of expectation gap, the imagination gap, which occurs when our imagination exceeds reality. You see, when we choose to buy goods, we choose from a range of options. When we choose where to travel to, we often choose from a range of options. When we choose which leader to elect, we often choose from a range of options. And how do we make that decision? What we do is that we choose the one that we think will be the best. We choose the one that we imagine will be the best of all the options. And so what we do is that we try to maximize our utility at a given price. That's how most people make decisions. To do otherwise would be to choose an option that we didn't think would be as good, which seems a bit counterintuitive. Now, the problem here is that the very act of choosing the thing that we think will give us the greatest happiness, that very decision-making process is the thing that actually undermines our happiness. Because what it means is that when we then see reality, when we then experience it, whether it's the good or the place we travel to or the leader that we elect, it's highly likely that that reality won't live up to our expectation. And that leads to disappointment. And technology makes this so much worse. What technology allows is things that are actually unrealistic to appear real. Things that aren't even on the happiness scale are made to seem as though they are actually possible. We Photoshop things in, we airbrush things out, we digitally enhance photos. And what this does is it makes us romanticize travel. It makes us come up with fantastical ideas about places that reality simply can't live up to. So we think Sagrada Familia looks like this, when it actually looks like this. We think the Taj Mahal always looks like this, when actually often it looks like this. We think that the Mona Lisa looks like this, when actually if we go and visit it, it's more likely to look like this. What technology does is that it skews our vision, it distorts reality, and makes the unreal seem real. Indeed, many of the times that when we're happiest when we go traveling, they're actually the times when we stumble across things we didn't expect, when we discover things for ourselves, where we don't have preconceived notions of different places. And what also makes this worse is selection bias. Many content-based algorithms, whether it's Google search or Facebook newsfeed, the way that it presents information is that it prioritizes those things that are the best images, the most shared images, the most liked images. You're more likely to be shown a photo on Facebook if it has 200 likes than if it has two. And so we come to think of the best images as being normal, as being average. And this also plays with our imagination. That's selection bias. Then there's persuasion. Because politicians often get elected on the basis of promising things that they can't deliver by raising our expectations. I mean, who would you be more likely to vote for? A politician that says, I'll fix your problems if you vote for me, or someone who says, perhaps more honestly, things will probably be the same whether you vote for me or not. You're probably going to vote for the former, but you're probably going to be disappointed as well. And so we're in this constant cycle of expectations being raised and hopes being dashed. That's the same with companies. I mean, companies are more likely to tell us that watches have never performed tasks so quickly. They're probably not going to tell us batteries have never run out so quickly, both of which are true. And so when you have technology, when you have persuasion, and when you have selection bias, what that means is that we imagine and demand and expect more than reality can provide. And when the limitless potential of our minds is met by the confined nature of Earth, we're disappointed. We're unhappy. Expectations and disappointments irrevocably intertwine. In terms of beauty, it's no wonder that self-esteem levels are so low. I mean, advertisers learned long ago that if you can make people hate themselves, you can sell them things. Now they're applying it time and time again. And we see this. What we see is advertisers showing only the best before and after photos. What we see is pictures of models who are made to seem perfect even though they're not. We've become a society of complainers, of perfectionists, of counterfactual historians, people who always imagine different and better outcomes for ourselves, but people whose imagination can't be satisfied. So that's the imagination gap. That's why our imagination exceeds reality, and that's the first main reason why we're unhappy. The second main type of expectation that we have, I like to call the interpersonal gap. It's where we compare our reality to the reality of others. Put simply, we judge ourselves based on what we experience around us. If you earn $50,000 and you're in a poor neighborhood, you'll feel rich. If you earn $50,000 and you're in a wealthy neighborhood, you'll feel poor. If you get a small pay rise, but everyone around you gets a large pay rise, you'll be disappointed. Your gain is someone's pain. Someone's pain is your gain. Unfortunately, it's a bit of a zero-sum game, or so it seems. And it's not only relative income that matters. It's also relative appearance that matters. One person's plastic surgery is another's psychic loss. Indeed, research has shown that we're actually happier when we're with worse-looking people because we're perceived by others to be objectively better-looking. So now when your friend asks you to come to a bar or to a club with them, you know why. And what's particularly interesting about this is that we have an asymmetry of emphasis. We prioritize, we focus on one end of the spectrum. We focus on the rich, the famous, the beautiful, and pay less attention to the other end. And so we're made to seem poorer. We're made to feel poorer, made to feel less successful than we actually are. It's almost as though we're running on a hedonic treadmill, constantly striving to be happy, but getting no closer. Because when our standard of living improves, if everyone else's standard of living improves as well, we don't always feel happier. So that's the second way in which we form expectations, based on others around us. The third and final way is based on our past, based on our past experiences. I call this the intertemporal gap. And we're unhappy when our past reality is better than our present reality. Take two people who have the same average lifetime income, but person A whose income decreases over their lifetime, person B whose income increases. Now, research shows that you're always happier if you're person B, if you have that increasing income, even though the average might be the same. Why is this? It's because of something that psychologists refer to as anchoring. We compare to our past, and if you're constantly improving, constantly exceeding expectations, constantly moving forward, you're generally happy. The reverse is true if you're person A. And so what this means in terms of raising children, I think often we tend to spoil children. We tend to give them everything, to want to give them the best start in life. But often the best intentions don't always lead to the best outcomes. Yes, we should support children, but if we give them everything, then it's much harder for them to have what I call a positive intertemporal gradient. It's harder for them to improve over time throughout their life, and that actually potentially undermines their happiness. And while I'm talking about parenting, I think another problem in our society is that we tend to tell children that they're special, that they're unique, that they're one of a kind, that they're amazing. We tell them that they can be prime minister or president, that they can be the next Mark Zuckerberg. We tell them that they'll be Beyonce one day. What this means is that we raise their expectations. And so when that child gets a normal job, when they start a business and it fails like most do, when their singing career peaks with a rendition of Single Ladies in the Shower, they're disappointed. They're unhappy. Their expectations haven't been satisfied. Yes, we want to give children self-belief, but we don't want to delude them and we don't want to delude ourselves. So what we see is that our happiness is largely determined by expectations. Our expectations are largely determined by what we consider to be normal. And what we consider to be normal is largely based on our imagination, based on others around us, and based on our past. And so we have these constant battles, the battle between our imagination and our reality, the battle between the reality that we experience and what we think or perceive that others experience, the battle between our reality and our past reality. How can we win these battles? Well, I think the first challenge, the challenge for entrepreneurs and businessmen, for parents, for legislators, for magazine editors, is to take happiness seriously, to take expectations seriously. I think often we relegate happiness to the world of art, not science. We dismiss it. We think of it in terms of hippies rather than businessmen. What we want is for entrepreneurs to focus on actually improving contentment, not just increasing consumption. In terms of winning the imagination battle, I think it's important that we make it known to content providers the importance of actually having realistic representations of images, people, and places and events. And we might even go so far as to ban things like digital enhancement in ads. In terms of winning the interpersonal battle, I think it's important that governments prioritize income equality. and that we learn to compete against ourselves rather than against others. And in terms of that intertemporal battle, I think it's important that we support kids, encourage kids, but also make them realize when it's impossible and not to give them completely unrealistic expectations. Let me conclude. We seem to have been seduced into a way of life that almost conspires in every way against the most basic level of contentment. We're terrible predictors of what will make us happy. I mean, anytime monkeys beat you, you know there's a problem. We're terrible predictors of happiness because the way in which we rationalize, the way in which we make decisions is often on the basis of actual levels, absolute levels. But the way in which we feel is based on relative outcomes, based on expectations. It's expectations that explains why a bronze medalist can be happier than a silver medalist. Because the silver medalist imagines coming first, the bronze medalist imagines coming fourth. It's expectations that explains why often lottery winners aren't that happy. Their happiness doesn't last because they don't have that increasing level of satisfaction throughout their life. It's expectations that explains why you can be happier with an income of $40,000 to an income of $50,000. We often think of happiness in isolation, in a vacuum, when in reality our happiness is far more complicated. It's far more intertwined with our community, our imagination, and our past. And it's important that we think carefully about how our minds work, how our feelings work, how our expectations work. And it's important that we change the way in which we make decisions so that our thinking process matches our feeling process. Ladies and gentlemen, for entrepreneurs that want to improve the lives of others, as well as for people that want to be happy, I think the first step is understanding why we're unhappy. And I hope that the next time, if ever it happens, that your decision-making prowess is compared to that of monkeys, I hope you come out on top. Thank you.
All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about disappointment and we are having a series of conversations with people that are talking about disappointment in different areas. So the last speaker was talking about disappointment when it comes to business and he spoke about the three gaps within the expectation realm and how exactly we are going, where we place ourselves, right? So didn't I say it? Didn't I say it was all expectations? It was all expectations. I believe that we have so many expectations and expectations are the ones that are holding us back from our true potential and from our real joy. So I think that it is a very wonderful Friday afternoon. I'm a little woozy and I think I have got like my blood pressure is a little skyrocketing. I don't know. I've got like this tension headache that is happening, but I'm here nonetheless, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm sharing the information that I've researched on. And we are listening. We are having the classroom experience. Now, I'm often asked, why do you overshare? Why do you share so much? And I believe that if we share stories, right, and we share experiences and we share our thoughts, then definitely somewhere, somehow, it's going to impact somebody's life in a positive way. But some lady said it better.
So I'm going to come right out with it. My sister was murdered nearly a decade ago, and basically I can't shut up about it. So much so that I've co-written and I perform a one-woman show which deals with the very early days of her absence. I was lucky enough to meet a guy called Martin M. Bartelt, who's a dancer, choreographer, director, writer, film editor, you get the picture. And together we made the show. We've toured it nationally and internationally. It's been published and I have performed it 103 times. People often think the show is about my sister, because it's called Sometimes I Laugh Like My Sister. But I have to put them right. The show is about me. This is about my grief, my loss, my sister. My grief is about me. Which is the kind of thing I say at dinner parties. Used to say at dinner parties. I don't get invited to so many dinner parties anymore. I've witnessed a world where people don't talk about grief, about loss. They can't. And I've resided nearly all of my life in a world where that seems perfectly natural to me to talk about it. I've witnessed what happens when these two worlds collide, when people who are suffering loss of whatever kind want to communicate about it and other people just feel they can't. And my suggestion is that we can make the collision between those two worlds less turbulent. My dad died when I was 6, and I was tremendously lucky to grow up in a household where no question was unwelcome, even questions about death. Especially questions about death, actually. So that I would go, this little kid, I'd go to other people's houses and ask my questions, and I realized they were very unwelcome. And I found it really confusing. I mean, I still don't understand why I can't talk about death at dinner parties. People seem to think I can provoke their death by mentioning it. It's actually not a superpower that I have. But I think you can disempower something by naming it. Mention your fear and it might just dissipate. So I want to talk about and hear about things that really matter. I don't quite understand what's taboo. And so most of the time I'm just staggeringly inappropriate. So Martin, who I mentioned, has rheumatoid arthritis. So his hands don't look like most people's hands. And he was on a bus once. And there was a woman with her little boy. And the little boy turned to his mum, as little children do, and said, "Mummy, why has that man got funny hands?" So mummy was, you know, going, "Shut up." And Martin said, "It's fine. Let him ask." And so he asked, and Martin answered, including the little boy asked, "Am I going to have hands like yours? Are my hands going to hurt?" And Martin said, "I don't think so. It's really rare for little boys like you to have hands like mine." And then the little boy said, "What are you reading?" And they started a pretty intense discussion about dragons, because they established they had a similar taste in literature. Children aren't afraid of revealing their ignorance, their curiosity. But they learn as they go through life that they shouldn't ask the question, they shouldn't reveal themselves or their lack of knowledge, so that we can end up, as adults, terrified, but unable to talk to anybody about it, for fear of what? Have you ever crossed the street or thought about crossing the street to avoid somebody? I mean, I don't mean your ex or that woman you owe money to. I mean someone who's just had a diagnosis of cancer or whose child died recently. Fear. fear is a many splendid thing. But whatever causes it, it engenders exactly the same feeling inside us. I separate fear into useful and useless fear. So we've got useful fear, so don't put your hand in the barbecue. Don't run across the motorway. You get my drift. Useless fear. Fear of swooping bats. Fear of large roomfuls of people. Fear of the trauma of others. Fear of saying the wrong thing. Fear of upsetting somebody. Fear of the unknown. We fear the stranger quite a lot of the time, even though we are statistically far more likely to come to harm at the hands of somebody we know and love and who loves us than we are at the hands of that random stranger. Be careful how you listen to your fear, because it can rule us. I mean, I often, when I'm thinking about these things, as I do, I imagine the Greek gods, you know, the ancient Greek gods sitting up on Mount Olympus, and I just think of them laughing their heads off as they watch us, unable to communicate with each other, unable to ask the childlike question, separating ourselves out from one another for fear of what will become of us. Fear is catching. It spreads like wildfire. And what I'm suggesting is that each of us can be a fire break. We can stop the fear in its tracks across the mountain. Do you know that feeling the day before you go somewhere new for the first time? Somewhere important. You know, you imagine the hospital ward or your new office. I mean, you might have seen a bit of it, but your imagination is filling in the rest. And then when you get there, suddenly, it can be quite hard to remember that image you had in your head of this place. Now that you've seen it, it's here, it's so clear, it's so real. Well, difficult, unspeakable things happen in life, and we pass through a door into a new life. And it's just so real, it can be hard to remember who our old self was, that self who didn't have to have a filling, or before the car crash. When my sister died, this incredibly strong image came to me, and it stayed with me for a very long time, and it was this, that my life was on railway tracks, literal railway tracks, and in the moment of Kate's death, this glass wall dropped, and I was suddenly here, on the other side of the glass wall, on a new set of tracks, and I could see my old life through the glass wall, but I couldn't get to it. And my old life and my new life ran along together for a while. You can see in my diary from that time, I was meant to be having Trevor, lunch with Trevor. Wow. It's going to be disturbing when my mum sees this. I was meant to be having lunch with my mate Trevor. Seriously, you can see my diary, all right? It's in there as lunch. And I was meant to be having lunch with him the day after Kate died. Well, I never did have lunch with Trevor or anything else. And gradually, inexorably, these two sets of tracks pull apart. And I can see my old life, but I can't get to it. This isn't what I want, but it's going out of my reach. And I'm stuck here on these, frankly, inferior tracks. We become a new person, often an unwanted new person, and it is hard for us. But it is tremendously hard often for the people around us. They don't know how to talk to us. Our trauma is frightening for them. And so a space opens up between us and those closest to us, and these two worlds grind against each other, and we withdraw. I used to be a person who liked going to parties. And when Kate died, I, for a long time, quite a few years, I was no longer a person who wanted to go to a party. But it was really hard for my friends and for me to believe that was the case. So they'd invite me to parties, and sometimes I'd go. And I was at this party, and a good friend of mine said to me, "How are you?" And I started to tell her how I was. And as I started to talk, the tears started to flow unbidden, as they did all the time in those days, in meetings, on public transport, trying to make a decision about tinned soup. And she said to me, "Oh, I didn't mean to upset you." And I said, "You didn't upset me. The man who shot Kate upset me." Of course, what I should have said, what I subsequently realized I meant, was, "I know none of us can change what has happened, but thank you for bearing witness. Please be there for all difficult times, though I know you can't solve it, solve me. But I am now this person, as I was the person who had this magical, fantastical big sister. I am now the person who no longer has her, and I seem to be considerably less fun than I used to be." And all this was one of the reasons I wanted to make the show. Excuse me. I wanted to see if I could come to a place with all my stuff, and other people might come with all their stuff, and we'd meet in a place of safety where we were sure to say the wrong things to each other and upset each other the whole time. But that was okay. It was done with kindness. It was done like a child. The childlike question, the discussion you have with a kid, and sometimes silence. That's okay too. And what places Martin and I have been to with this show, it's been extraordinary, but the big thing is we've discovered there is such a thirst for people to tell their stories, to be seen, to be known. And everybody wants to ask something of somebody else. My basic desire was to touch one person with my show, just one. I thought if I did that, the job would be done. And on the first night of the show, I was having a drink. Yes, I was. I was quite relieved. And I hadn't made any mistakes about my friend Trevor in that show. And this woman told me, and Martin, this story. She had been 30 years previously in a queue to see some musical theater with a friend. And a man had come up and stabbed her friend in the back. And the man had died there, on the pavement. And she told us that some of her reactions, which she had thought for 30 years were peculiar and out of the ordinary, she had discovered in our show that they were just the kind of things that people who suffered sudden traumatic loss experience. So I'm going to end with a plea, with a rallying cry, actually. Tell your stories of loss, your stories of disappointment, your stories of fear. And ask the childlike question with kindness and be open for the answer. You don't know what it's going to be. It's not your business to predict it. Or indeed the silence. Be open for that as well. Do not listen to your useless fear. You can, by opening yourself to other people, simply change the world. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you guys are inspired out there because we're going through the motions, ladies and gentlemen. And it's one of those Friday evenings where we are really just diving into the different lessons of life, right?
I'm here this morning to contribute a bit of my own experience to TEDx Port Harcourt, the alternate verse, to try to share with you some of the experiences I have had that have shaped my way of looking at things and my way of responding to things. Initially, when I was invited to be part of the TEDx experience in Port Harcourt, I'd said no. But a few things happened around me that made me change my mind, and I decided to come here and share a bit of my story. First thing that happened was that a friend of mine, a lady who lives in the U.S., she's actually a Nigerian, and she has a son who has actually never been to Nigeria. And this boy is growing up. He has his own values. He has his own way of looking at life. He has his own understanding of what success means and what the future should hold. And the mother was very worried about his views and the way he was going. And so she called me up and asked me if I could spare some time to talk with her son. I agreed. I got his number. I called him. We talked a few times. And I told him to try and write down his goals and visions in life, so he could discuss it with me. When he did that and we talked over the phone, I found myself thinking that there were quite a few gaps in the way he was looking at the world, in the way he was looking at himself and the future, and in the way I would see it from my own perspective. So I decided to do what my own father always did anytime we had issues that we couldn't agree on. I decided to write him a letter, because I felt that doing that, I'll be able to share my own perception of what he was doing with him without necessarily trashing his own vision and his views. So while I was thinking of writing this letter, I got a call from my wife, and she wanted me to talk to my own son basically about the same thing. And in talking to me, she sounded exactly like the mother in the U.S. So this time, I didn't need a phone. My son is right here with me in Nigeria. So we got into some father and son engagement. And in talking to him, I found out that my own son also sounded exactly like the young man in the U.S. And so I decided that I should share my own experience, my vision and understanding of what being successful could mean to people at this time. So I came to Port Harcourt to share that experience with everybody, that's you and me. Part of why I decided to do that is that I understand that everybody wants to be successful. And there's really every incentive for us to be successful. In fact, success in today's world just goes beyond the ability to pay your bills and to meet up with the expectations of society. Success includes the ability to influence your environment, the ability to be able to affect things around you, and a whole lot of other things. And there's a lot of pressure on young people to be successful. Now, in being successful, a lot of people seem to define success in terms of something you get at the end of life's journey. You know, a destination, and your journey ends when you become successful. But I understand success differently. You have to be successful every day. And you cannot be successful on your own, by yourself to yourself. Your success must involve your community. It must involve people. It must involve compassion for others. It must also make room for other people to be successful. So in trying to piece together what I understand by this and share it with you, I went back to my own life, how I started my journey in politics. A long time ago, that was about 1996, when the politics of the Fourth Republic was starting with the formation of the party called the UNCP. I was a lawyer. I was in my office, and some politicians from my place came to invite me to come and contest for the House of Assembly at that time. Now, I had a friend then who was like my idol. He was my mentor. He was the richest person I knew. He had a Jaguar. He had a Bentley. He was very well educated, very wealthy, and very, very intelligent. And I adored him. He used to spend about a few months in Nigeria, but most of the time he lived outside the country. So whenever he was around, I made every effort to try to spend as much time with him as I possibly could. He was my role model. He meant a lot to me. Now, when these politicians invited me, I decided to go and talk to this my idol about what I had been asked to do and my decision to go into politics. He kept me in his house till 2 a.m. in the morning. He encouraged me. He told me that, in fact, that is the best news he has had, that this was an opportunity for us to change the course of our country, for us to do things differently, for us to change the way people look at politics in Nigeria, that he felt I could do all these things and that I should go ahead and go and contest the election. He will sponsor me. He will fund me. I shouldn't look at it as something I was doing for myself. I should look at something that we were going to do for Nigeria. And everything that would be involved, he would cater for it. I had no more reason to talk to anybody else. I left his house that day. I was practically walking on air. And then I had told these politicians to come back in a week. There was no need to wait for 1 week after what he told me. I called them back immediately. I was ready and I was good to go. And so we started. Every week as we went around, I was borrowing money, I was running around, and I would go back to my mentor and my idol and say, this is where we have gone. Can I have some money now to do the things that we had promised? And he told me no. He didn't want to give me the money piecemeal. He was going to give me enough money to take care of everything and take care of the elections so that even if he was abroad when the elections would come up, I would not need to ask anybody for anything. I should just go ahead. He's trying to gather enough money together to make it work for me. And so I would go back, I would borrow money, I would run around, and I would go back to him the next week. He said, no, the money is so much, he's still putting it together. And I never doubted him for a minute. So the next week I would go back, and then I would come back again. You say, no, come the next week. We went on and on. In that whole time, I was accumulating debts, but I was also working in the community because I actually believed the message and the inspirational message that he gave to me. And then finally, one day, I came to see him. And he said I should come back the next week, Tuesday, in the morning at 9 o'clock. And so that next week, Tuesday, I came back and I met him at 9 o'clock. And he said the money was ready, but they were bringing it from Aba. It was a lot of money and he needed to put it together. I should come back at 3 o'clock. I was so happy and I went back. At about 3 o'clock, I came back to his house. When I got to the house, the gate was locked. I was hooting on my car. Nobody came out. So I came out of the car and started banging on the gate. And then the security man came and he asked me, what are you doing here? I said, Oga said I should come back at 3 o'clock. He was like, what do you mean? But you were here in the morning. I said, yes, I was here in the morning. He said, he didn't tell you that he was going to America today. I said, no, he didn't tell me. He said, well, he has gone to America and he's not back till next year. It was like my world had come to an end. The only reason I didn't have a heart attack that day is because I didn't have a heart attack that day. The sun went out. And then I didn't know when I started crying. I was weeping like a child. I was sobbing. And people had gathered on the streets to watch me. And this security man took me into the gatehouse. He kept me there while I was crying. He went, he bought a bottle of Ragolis water. He washed my face. He tried to talk to me, but I couldn't hear because I was sobbing and I was sobbing and I was sobbing. I was in that security house for over 2 hours with the gate man. And he was talking to me, consoling me. He inspired me afresh. And he got me to know that whatever man has promised me, I did not need to depend on any man. Even if this man had failed me, I could still go ahead and achieve all the things that I wanted to achieve. He talked to me. You wouldn't believe that he had no education. You wouldn't believe that he was just a security man to a very wealthy man. But by the time that man finished with me that day, I was able to get up, get into my car, and drive back. And I was able to understand that my life and my politics was not over. I was able to believe that I could still go ahead and achieve great things despite the greatest disappointment that I have ever suffered at that time. This man was a security man at the gate. My friend in whom I trusted, that I adored, that I believed in so much, was a billionaire. But his word was not worth anything to me at the time I needed it. No matter what you are, no matter who you are, without integrity, you are nothing. If your word does not mean anything, your success also cannot mean much. You cannot succeed where you are not involved with the community, where you cannot turn around to look at the challenges that others are facing. There is a quote, famous quote by Alexander Pope, where he said, "Then teach me heaven to scorn the guilty babes. Drive from my breast this wretched lust of praise. Unblemished let me live or die unknown. Oh, grant me an honest fame or grant me none." If you cannot have your success unblemished, sometimes what you may define as success may not actually make you successful in the eyes of others. If you cannot contribute to the growth of other people, if you cannot participate in the community, if you see success as a definition, as a destination where you would arrive at the end of your struggle, then your whole struggle may not be worth anything, because in the course of your journey, you're not successful. My father would always say, and I later got to know, that he got that from the Saint Christ, where he would tell me all the time, that listen, he say, yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every dream a dream of happiness, and makes every vision a vision of hope. He said, look ye therefore to this day. Success is what you do every single day. Success is how you affect people every day of your life. Success is how you contribute to others around you. When I was a child, I remember a day my mother was so miserable, and I followed her to the market. I carried her wares. I stayed with her in the market. And at the end of the day, I had about 30 kobo on me, and I bought her a red bangle. I discovered that I later grew up to be a man. I bought a car for my mom, but she did not value anything as much as she valued that red bangle that I bought for her as a child. If I had waited for me to grow old and have money before I could make my mother happy, my mother probably would have died a very miserable person. So yes, we can be successful. Yes, we can join the rat race, and we should join the rat race, because what puts you in the rat race is that your bills start chasing you, and you have to keep running so that your bills don't overtake you. If you allow your bills to overtake you, they will overwhelm you. So to stay ahead of your bills and to stay ahead of the competition, you are already in the rat race, whether you like it or not. But in the middle of that race, you must remember that you cannot go it alone, and you must remember to turn around and look at what is happening to other people. I say to everybody that the night sky is always that much more beautiful when there are so many stars in the sky. If you are the lone star in the sky and you cannot make way for other stars to shine, then you may not be as successful as you would like to think of yourself. So in pushing our way forward through life, it is important that we remember that success in the terms in which we understand it is important, but success in the terms of the contribution you make to the lives around you is just as important. Success is something you do every single day of your life. It is not the destination of your struggle. Indeed, that is a struggle itself. Thank you, and God bless you all.
What a story. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you are having the time of your life with the Chronicles of Conversations this evening.
So I'll start with this. A couple years ago, an event planner called me because I was going to do a speaking event, and she called and she said, "I'm really struggling with how to write about you on the little flyer." And I thought, "Well, what's the struggle?" And she said, "Well, I saw you speak, and I'm going to call you a researcher, I think, but I'm afraid if I call you a researcher, no one will come because they'll think you're boring and irrelevant." And I was like, "Okay." And she said, "But the thing I liked about your talk is, you know, you're a storyteller. So I think what I'll do is just call you a storyteller." And of course, the academic, insecure part of me was like, "You're going to call me a what?" And she said, "I'm going to call you a storyteller." And I was like, "Oh, why not magic pixie?" Let me think about this for a second. And so I tried to call deep on my courage, and I thought, you know, I am a storyteller. I'm a qualitative researcher. I collect stories. That's what I do. And maybe stories are just data with a soul, you know, and maybe I'm just a storyteller. So I said, "You know what? Why don't you just say I'm a researcher storyteller?" And she went, "There's no such thing." So I'm a researcher storyteller. And I'm going to talk to you today. We're talking about expanding perception. And so I want to talk to you and tell some stories about a piece of my research that fundamentally expanded my perception, and really actually changed the way that I live and love and work and parent. And this is where my story starts. When I was a young researcher, doctoral student, my first year I had a research professor who said to us, "Here's the thing. If you cannot measure it, it does not exist." And I thought he was just sweet talking to me. I was like, "Really?" And he's like, "Absolutely." So you have to understand that I have a bachelor's in social work, a master's in social work, and I was getting my PhD in social work. So my entire academic career was surrounded by people who kind of believed in the life's messy, love it, you know, and I'm more the life's messy, clean it up, organize it, and put it into a bento box. And so to think that I had found my way to found a career that takes me, you know, really one of the big sayings in social work is lean into the discomfort of the work. And I'm like, you know, knock discomfort upside the head and move it over and get all A's. That was my mantra. So I was very excited about this. And so I thought, you know what? This is the career for me because I am interested in some messy topics, but I want to be able to make them not messy. I want to understand them. I want to hack into these things that I know are important and lay the code out for everyone to see. So where I started was with connection, because by the time you're a social worker for 10 years, what you realize is that connection is why we're here. It's what gives purpose and meaning to our lives. This is what it's all about. It doesn't matter whether you talk to people who work in social justice and mental health and abuse and neglect. What we know is that connection, the ability to feel connected, is neurobiologically, that's how we're wired. It's why we're here. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to start with connection. Well, you know that situation where you get an evaluation from your boss and she tells you 37 things that you do really awesome and one thing that you can't, you know, an opportunity for growth. And all you can think about is that opportunity for growth, right? Well, apparently this is the way my work went as well, because when you ask people about love, they tell you about heartbreak. When you ask people about belonging, they'll tell you their most excruciating experiences of being excluded. And when you ask people about connection, the stories they told me were about disconnection. So very quickly, really about 6 weeks into this research, I ran into this unnamed thing that absolutely unraveled connection in a way that I didn't understand or had never seen. And so I pulled back out of the research and thought, I need to figure out what this is. And it turned out to be shame. And shame is really easily understood as the fear of disconnection. Is there something about me that if other people know it or see it, that I won't be worthy of connection? The things I can tell you about it, it's universal. We all have it. The only people who don't experience shame have no capacity for human empathy or connection. No one wants to talk about it, and the less you talk about it, the more you have it. What underpinned this shame, this I'm not good enough, which we all know that feeling, I'm not blank enough, I'm not thin enough, rich enough, beautiful enough, smart enough, promoted enough. The thing that underpinned this was excruciating vulnerability. This idea of, in order for connection to happen, we have to allow ourselves to be seen, really seen. And you know how I feel about vulnerability. I hate vulnerability. And so I thought, this is my chance to beat it back with my measuring stick. I'm going in. I'm going to figure this stuff out. I'm going to spend a year. I'm going to totally deconstruct shame. I'm going to understand how vulnerability works, and I'm going to outsmart it. So I was ready, and I was really excited. As you know, it's not going to turn out well. You know this. So I could tell you a lot about shame, but I'd have to borrow everyone else's time. But here's what I can tell you that it boils down to. And this may be one of the most important things that I've ever learned in the decade of doing this research. My 1 year has turned into 6 years, thousands of stories, hundreds of long interviews, focus groups. At one point, people were sending me journal pages and sending me their stories, thousands of pieces of data, and 6 years. And I kind of got a handle on it. I kind of understood this is what shame is. This is how it works. I wrote a book. I published a theory, but something was not okay. And what it was is that if I roughly took the people I interviewed and divided them into people who really have a sense of worthiness, that's what this comes down to, a sense of worthiness. They have a strong sense of love and belonging. And folks who struggle for it, and folks who are always wondering if they're good enough. There was only one variable that separated the people who had a strong sense of love and belonging and the people who really struggle for it, and that was the people who have a strong sense of love and belonging believe they're worthy of love and belonging. That's it. They believe they're worthy. And to me, the hard part of the one thing that keeps us out of connection is our fear that we're not worthy of connection was something that personally and professionally I felt like I needed to understand better. So what I did is I took all of the interviews where I saw worthiness, where I saw people living that way, and just looked at those. What do these people have in common? And I have a slight office supply addiction, but it's another talk. So I had a manila notebook, a manila folder, and I had a Sharpie, and I was like, what am I going to call this research? And the first words that came to my mind were wholehearted. These are kind of wholehearted people living from this deep sense of worthiness. So I wrote at the top of the manila folder, and I started looking at the data. In fact, I did it first in this very four-day, very intensive data analysis where I went back, pulled these interviews, pulled the stories, pulled the incidents. What's the theme? What's the pattern? My husband left town with the kids because I always go into this kind of Jackson Pollock crazy thing where I'm just like writing and going and kind of just in my researcher mode. And so here's what I found. What they had in common was a sense of courage. And I want to separate courage and bravery for you for a minute. Courage, the original definition of courage, when it first came into the English language, it's from the Latin word cur, meaning heart, And the original definition was to tell the story of who you are with your whole heart. And so these folks had, very simply, the courage to be imperfect. They had the compassion to be kind to themselves first and then to others, because as it turns out, we can't practice compassion with other people if we can't treat ourselves kindly. And the last was they had connection, and this was the hard part, as a result of authenticity. They were willing to let go of who they thought they should be in order to be who they were, which is, you have to absolutely do that for connection. The other thing that they had in common was this. They fully embraced vulnerability. They believed that what made them vulnerable made them beautiful. They didn't talk about vulnerability being comfortable, nor did they really talk about it being excruciating, as I had heard earlier in the shame interviewing. They just talked about it being necessary. They talked about the willingness to say, I love you first. The willingness to do something where there are no guarantees. The willingness to breathe through waiting for the doctor to call after your mammogram. The willing to invest in a relationship that may or may not work out. They thought this was fundamental. I personally thought it was betrayal. I could not believe I had pledged allegiance to research, where our job, you know, the definition of research is to control and predict, to study phenomenon for the reason, for the explicit reason to control and predict. And now my very, you know, my mission to control and predict had turned up the answer that the way to live is with vulnerability and to stop controlling and predicting. This led to a little breakdown, which actually looked more like this. And it did. It led to I call it a breakdown. My therapist calls it a spiritual awakening. Spiritual awakening sounds better than breakdown, but I assure you it was a breakdown. And I had to put my data away and go find a therapist. Let me tell you something. You know who you are when you call your friends and say, I think I need to see somebody. Who, do you have any recommendations? Because about five of my friends are like, woo, I wouldn't want to be your therapist. And I was like, what does that mean? And they're like, I'm just saying, you know, like, don't bring your measuring stick. Okay. So I found a therapist. My first meeting with her, Diana, I brought in my list of the way the wholehearted live. And I sat down and she said, you know, how are you? And I said, I'm great. You know, I'm okay. And she said, what's going on? And I said, and this is a therapist who sees therapists because we have to go to those because their BS meters are good. And so I said, here's the thing, I'm struggling. And she said, what's the struggle? And I said, well, I have a vulnerability issue. And, you know, and I know that vulnerability is kind of the core of shame and fear and our struggle for worthiness. But it appears that it's also the birthplace of joy, of creativity, of belonging, of love. And I think I have a problem. And I need some help. And I said, but here's the thing, no family stuff, no childhood shit. I just need some strategies. Thank you. So she goes like this. And then I said, it's bad, right? And she said, it's neither good nor bad. It just is what it is. And I said, oh my God, this is going to suck. And it did, and it didn't. And it took about a year. And you know how there are people that, like, when they realize that vulnerability and tenderness are important, that they kind of surrender and walk into it? A, that's not me. And B, I don't even hang out with people like that. For me, it was a year-long street fight. It was a slugfest. Vulnerability pushed, I pushed back. I lost the fight, but probably won my life back. And so then I went back into the research and spent the next couple of years really trying to understand what they, the wholehearted, what the choices they were making, and what are we doing with vulnerability? Why do we struggle with it so much? Am I alone in struggling with vulnerability? No. So this is what I learned. We numb vulnerability. When we're waiting for the call, it was funny. I sent something out on Twitter and on Facebook that says, how would you define vulnerability? What makes you feel vulnerable? And within an hour and a half, I had 150 responses. Because I wanted to know, you know, what's out there? Having to ask my husband for help because I'm sick and we're newly married. Initiating sex with my husband. Initiating sex with my wife. Being turned down. Asking someone out. Waiting for the doctor to call back. Getting laid off. Laying off people. This is the world we live in. We live in a vulnerable world. And one of the ways we deal with it is we numb vulnerability. And I think there's evidence, and it's not the only reason this evidence exists, but I think that there, it's a huge cause. We are the most in debt, obese, addicted, and medicated adult cohort in U.S. history. The problem is, and I learned this from the research, that you cannot selectively numb emotion. You can't say, here's the bad stuff. Here's vulnerability. Here's grief. Here's shame. Here's fear. Here's disappointment. I don't want to feel these. I'm going to have a couple of beers and a banana nut muffin. I don't want to feel these. And I know that's knowing laughter. I hack into your lives for a living. I know that's, God. You can't numb those hard feelings without numbing the other affects or emotions. You cannot selectively numb. So when we numb those, we numb joy. We numb gratitude. We numb happiness. And then we are miserable and we are looking for purpose and meaning. And then we feel vulnerable. So then we have a couple of beers and a banana nut muffin. And it becomes this dangerous cycle. One of the things that I think that we need to think about is why and how we numb. And it doesn't just have to be addiction. The other thing we do is we make everything that's uncertain, certain. Religion has gone from a belief in faith and mystery to certainty. I'm right, you're wrong, shut up. That's it. Just certain. The more afraid we are, the more vulnerable we are, the more afraid we are. This is what politics looks like today. There's no discourse anymore. There's no conversation. There's just blame. You know what blame, you know how blame is described in the research? A way to discharge pain and discomfort. We perfect, if there's anyone who wants their life to look like this, it would be me. But it doesn't work. Because what we do is we take fat from our butts and put it in our cheeks. Which just, I hope in 100 years people will look back and go, wow. You know. And we perfect, most dangerously, our children. Let me tell you what we think about children. They're hardwired for struggle when they get here. When you hold those perfect little babies in your hand, our job is not to say, look at her, she's perfect. My job is just to keep her perfect, make sure she makes the tennis team by fifth grade and Yale by seventh grade. That's not our job. Our job is to look and say, you know what? You're imperfect and you're wired for struggle, but you are worthy of love and belonging. That's our job. Show me a generation of kids raised like that and we'll end the problems I think that we see today. We pretend that what we do doesn't have an effect on people. We do that in our personal lives. We do that corporate, whether it's a bailout, an oil spill, a recall. We pretend like what we're doing doesn't have a huge impact on other people. I would say to companies, this is not our first rodeo, people. We just need you to be authentic and real and say, we're sorry. we'll fix it. But there's another way, and I'll leave you with this. This is what I have found. To let ourselves be seen. Deeply seen. Vulnerably seen. To love with our whole hearts, even though there's no guarantee. And that's really hard. And I can tell you as a parent, that's excruciatingly difficult. To practice gratitude and joy in those moments of kind of terror when we're wondering, can I love you this much? Can I believe in this as passionately? Can I be this fierce about this? Just to be able to stop and instead of catastrophizing what might happen to say, I'm just so grateful. Because to feel this vulnerable means I'm alive. And the last, which I think is probably the most important, is to believe that we're enough. Because when we work from a place, I believe, that says, I'm enough, then we stop screaming and start listening. We're kinder and gentler to the people around us, and we're kinder and gentler to ourselves. That's all I have. Thank you.
I'm going to begin with a story that I never anticipated or hoped to tell in public. I started and ran a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. called Innovation Network. I started that in the early 1990s. About 8 years into my tenure, my office manager, Mary, asked to meet with me.
Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, the sound quality on that one is not appropriate, so we'll move on to our next clip. I hope we're having a good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
I want you to fail. Each and every one of you. And I'm not talking about something small like missing the birth of your firstborn child. You can laugh. It's okay. That's funny. No. I want you to fail massively. Now, I'm not a cynic or a pessimist. And in reality, I really just want you to succeed. But I believe failing does not make you a failure, but can bring you closer to success. Failing can teach you a lesson, and it can give you perspective. In my experience, as a first-generation brown girl, raised by two Indian immigrant parents, failure was unacceptable. We were taught to achieve, succeed, and be the best. So achieve, succeed, and be the best we did. We were praised for our good grades, lauded for being at the top of the class. And what we didn't see was that though my parents didn't expect perfection, you know, 98 out of 100 on the algebra exam, that was tolerable, that we were still using success and failure as a measure of who we were. I was using success and failure as a measure of who I was. Success meant I was good. Failure meant I was bad. I was so focused on the anticipated outcomes of success that I failed to see the lessons along the way. Now, my maiden name is But. Yes, But. Spelled B-H-A-T-T. So naturally, you think you'd open up the phone book and find them under the B's, right? But I'm going to let you in on a little family secret. They were actually listed under the G's. G-U-I-L-T. Or as my sister and I like to call them, the guilts. Now, don't get me wrong. My parents were our most fervent advocates and cheerleaders. They just wanted us to make our way in the world, to really tap into our potential and work hard. But anytime I strayed from the plan, gosh, I felt so disappointed in myself. I felt bad. I felt like I wasn't enough. And I felt guilty. Not because of what my parents said, but because of my self-imposed measure of success and failure. As a first-generation brown woman and mother of two young brown boys, I found that I've carried on the family name, the guilt. Try harder. Why aren't you getting this right the first time? I said this as my son fervently erased the B that was supposed to be a D. You can't go into kindergarten not knowing your B from your D. You're smart. Act like it. Think. Use your brain. I was frustrated. And as I happened to look down at my sweet 5.5-year-old son's face, look up at me in disappointment and sadness and guilt, it hit me. Unlike my parents, here I was absolutely expecting success and perfection from my son. I was implicitly teaching him that failure was unacceptable. It was a negative to be avoided. It was not okay. And though my son got his B and D mixed up, I was the one who had gotten it all wrong. I had gotten failure all wrong. My sweet 5.5-year-old son's face taught me two realizations about failure. Realization number one, failure is a lesson to be learned. When I first found out I was pregnant for the first time, I was elated, over the moon, and I was committed to being the most perfect mother ever. I was going to buy the anti-stretch mark cream and rub it all over on day one. I was going to fill my maternity wardrobe with all the cutest outfits from Ann Taylor the Loft. I was going to work out and eat right and be fit. I had this motherhood thing down. Oreo stole my vision from me. Double stuffed Oreos, to be specific. I literally ate half a pack of Oreos every day of my last trimester, and what happened 50 pounds later was far from perfection. I went in for my first labor induction at 1 p.m. on a Tuesday afternoon, and by 7 p.m. that evening, my OB solemnly came in and said, "Your induction has failed." But I chose to see the light. And what was not a failure that day was the beautiful burrito bowl from Chipotle that my husband brought for me for dinner. You guys, the guacamole to sour cream ratio was perfection. My husband looked at me oddly and said, "Honey, I think you're just hungry." And I said, "Honey, I am so disappointed that you can't recognize a beautiful burrito bowl when you see one." After my second labor induction attempt, the result was not a beautiful burrito bowl, but instead the most beautiful baby boy I'd ever seen in my life. Perfect, even. But motherhood was tough. Breastfeeding was painful. Going back to work after 3 months, that felt like torture. I was sad, sleep deprived and depressed. I didn't see my baby enough. And I felt like I wasn't enough. I felt like a failure. After baby number two came along, I took that roll book and I threw it out the window. I breastfed for as long as I wanted to, and I took 2 years off to find my purpose again. As not just a mother, but as Radhika. What I viewed failure before was simply a lesson that I needed to learn. I didn't have to be the perfect mother. I was enough. I didn't have to have my hair in a classic messy bun while I wore my brand name loungewear in a picturesque pose breastfeeding my baby, like all the moms on Instagram. My kids didn't look like they just walked out of a Gap commercial. And even on my most unperfect days, I heard the words, "Mama, you're the best mama ever." Realization number two, failure is all about perspective. Growing up, I was known by a different name. I was not Radhika Bhatt, but I was Radhika Bhatt. Radhakanda, after the movie Anaconda came out. And my favorite, Radiculous. I know, that was a good one, right? I was made fun of the ways my knees looked. The classic Toyota tan-colored station wagon that I drove to school that got a lot of looks, but probably for all the wrong reasons. And last but not least, the lip hair that plagues every Indian girl at birth. I was made fun of for the things that I couldn't control. And though this wasn't failure in the conventional sense, I felt like one. Felt like I wasn't normal or enough. Today's quite different. My name is Radhika Bhatt Trivedi. My knees have served me well in this life. I think they're doing a stellar job right now, don't you think? Yes, let's give it up for the knees. Thank you. And let's just say laser hair removal has been a steadfast friend to me these past few decades. Shout out to Tanya in the back. Thank you. What I thought was success, how others viewed me, was not really success at all. But I realized that I could change how I viewed failure and that how I viewed myself was true victory. I used to believe failure was because I wasn't perfect.
Good evening.
You sound like an orphan amongst the strongest one of us. Sounds like an orphan in the last born.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm sick.
Oh,
I'm sick. And I'm sick, and I don't want to go home. And no, but I'm sick. So basically, I'm just summing up my research. Like, I was going to tell you all of these things that these people are saying, but.
I'm very observant, and then I see, I hear, and I know all, I think, to a certain extent.
Oh, okay. That's nice.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, the strongest suit of us.
Men down.
Sounds like an orphan.
Men down, guys, men down. Today's men down, guys.
You sound like there was an expression I made, like, I'm a motherless child a long way from home.
My dear. Oh, even if you get home, hey, your mother is not there.
It sounds like you today.
Nev?
Yeah.
I'm not feeling too well today.
The weather in Windhoek?
Oh, is it the weather or, I don't know, I've got this migraine that I've had since yesterday.
Oh.
And it's just on the right side of my face, and it's just killing me. My eye, it's just killing me. So tomorrow I'll go to the doctor in the morning and come to work in the afternoon.
Are you thinking too much?
Most probably. I always think too much. So it's never really out of the ordinary. I always think too much.
Much of anything
Can be bad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you came to close the show. What did you learn today?
With you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always what did you learn today.
Mm.
It's always an emotional roller coaster.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Like, you touch here, tomorrow you touch there, and you feel good today, and then tomorrow it's like
I'm serving the purpose.
Like a stone in your side.
Yes, I'm serving the purpose of the name of the show, guys. I'm pulling hard strings. I make you feel alive.
And then addressing the elephant in the room.
We are doing that, my dear.
Like, what I've learned today.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly the same lesson I get every day.
Mm-hmm.
So they are there's no sort of missing things from day to day.
Mm-hmm.
it's always the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what is that the same?
It's always like getting scolded by a parent that wants you to do best.
I am glad you got the assignment. I'm glad you understand the assignment.
You are the parents know that you are not living up to your full potential.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what this show is all about, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion.
But you live up to your fullest potential, because the only thing that's stopping you is you, isn't it?
Yes.
Everybody else is not really in your way. You are in your own way.
Yeah.
So, living with disappointment, understanding disappointment, and also lowering our expectations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And understanding that we're having expectations because of the times that we live in, and that is why we're disappointed. The times that we live in are times of perfection. Everything is deemed to be perfect. Everything that is fed to us is perfect. Everything that is put on the outside is perfect. So we internalize that perfection, that external perfection with internal perfection, and we can't live up to the standards of perfection. So we find disappointment within ourselves.
Lesson, life.
Lesson learned, my dear.
Mm.
I think that if we are looking at disappointment holistically and honestly, I think that none of us should be disappointed in anything, because nothing is permanent. So happiness is not permanent, but disappointment is also not permanent. Anger is not permanent, and joy is not permanent. You know, nothing is permanent. It's always moving. Even our age is not permanent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even our faces are not permanent, because the way you looked 20 years ago is not the way you look now. So who are we to ask for permanent structures when our whole entire existence is not permanent?
Like what I've learned from you the past 2 weeks, it's different from what I've learned over the years.
Really? We're going deeper, isn't it?
Yeah, like serendipity often finds people when they stop looking.
Yeah. Everything finds you when you stop looking.
From these 2 weeks,
it's your month.
Realized that, yeah, like serendipity often find people when they stop looking.
Mm.
I was like, oh, okay, so this is the realization I picked from every show.
Nah,
I make sure this show must find me into my comfort zone.
Comfort zone, so that nothing is disturbing you.
My youngest phone is with me.
Mm.
And then I put this AI applications where it just records everything, and then it writes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I put it here next to the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the matriarch speak, I think the youngest must come here. They must come gather.
Mm.
When these women speak, and I mean this with it in every sense of the word,
mm-hmm.
you should attentively listen.
Aww.
If you don't, no, like these things are not right. You won't find them in books.
Yeah.
It's here. It's live and. This is our podcast, man.
My dear, it's like watching the world unfold. But I think it's because of my experiences. I think I often fixate on things that I'm observing, that I'm experiencing in my life, and I kind of run with it, right? I kind of run with it, and then I run with it within shows. And right now, I'm at the stage where I'm living in answered prayers, right? But I can't seem to find gratitude, or I can't seem to find a way to express gratitude the way I want to express gratitude. I feel like it's not enough.
You're trying to find a spark.
I'm trying to find fireworks, my friend. Fireworks. I want fireworks. I want to throw a party for God. I want to come on the Pagirosh combo na peshtan penyo plota. So I'm having that dilemma, but then also, it is also linked to so many things, like the conversation around empathy and the conversation around dysfunctional families and the conversation of finding appropriate partners and the conversation about parenting, you know, and the questions that are also often in our minds and in our thoughts, but we can't seem to bring them out, right? And what the impact of these thoughts and these questions have on our day-to-day lives. So for me, the whole entire June is basically lower your expectations, please. Because if we lower our expectations, then nothing, there's absolutely nothing in the world that can hurt you. There's nothing that can give you joy. So that means, right, the joy that we will experience will be intentional joy. It is not joy that you stumble upon by accident, but intentional joy.
No, it's exactly the same joy you feel when the sun comes up.
Yeah. Kuchawu.
Yeah, with the same joy you get in the morning.
Yeah. But then also with the sun coming up, right? I believe that we have expectations of the sun coming up. One day the sun is not going to come up and all of us are going to, it's going to be a storm for us because we expect too much. So I'm trying to put down our expectations so that when good things happen, right, the climax is worth it. The climax is immaculate because right now we expect so much. And then most of the things that we get from the joy that we experience are half joys and half expressions because there was a hint of expectations. So it's like you going home and you know very well that nobody bought you anything. Nothing is happening today. Today is an ordinary day. And then you get home and then there is a gift that is special for you. The joy that you feel then in that moment and the appreciation that you feel in that moment is different from the expectations that you have of when your birthday is. So on the day of your birthday, you expect something. You don't know what it is, but you expect something. It's either a happy birthday, daddy, or it's either a card from someone, or it's a necklace of macaroni, or it is a message, but you expect something. But the joy that you get from unexpected surprises, pleasant surprises, right? I think if we lowered our expectations, our lives would be absolute climax.
When somebody introduced me to this radio station, so when I started being glued to this, especially this show, I was actually at the darkest stage of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I was just, you know, like trying to figure out, do I call God and then say, God, please, or do I fight a little bit longer?
Yeah.
And then I find comfort and then joy in the people that called me father or dad.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm alive today, especially because of my son.
Mm.
This is the person that I've seen him growing up, like from somebody who can get up on his own until to somebody who's like
walking and talking and having opinions and favorite things.
I mean, somebody who's like, can you just get out of my way? I want to go.
Do you remember where you come from, sir?
I remember there was this other day we just had the $50 in my pocket.
Mm.
My accounts were frozen from the time, and then I was like, when I got out of the shower, I finished washing him, and then when I get out of the shower, when we were about to go out of the house, I checked, like, I was like, we are just going to pick up, the bottle of milk, because I didn't introduce him to meat and everything.
Mm-hmm.
He just eats milk.
Mm-hmm.
When I checked I tried to log into my account, and then all the funds were revealed. Ah.
The unhealthy relationship we have with our banking apps, guys. No, I'm starting to think that is an unhealthy relationship that we're having there.
I was like, okay, fine.
How many times do you check your banking app a day?
I was actually living with a cousin, with my sister, with everybody at the house, and then it was an uncomfortable. Everybody's throwing languages at my son, and then me, and I was like, just hang on a little longer.
Mm.
So that day, I found people like building mm. like the ground break that the ground breaking.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, who's the owner of this place? Like it's on the advertisement board, like you, the one you sell solely.
Mm-hmm.
I called the place, and then I'm like, can I have a look at the design?
Mm, the plan.
Yeah, the plan and everything. And then I put on my little details. Can you finish this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can. I'll give you the, I'm like, we are just going to pay the whole thing.
Now.
Okay? yes. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. Oh. My tired was tired. Yeah. And then from there, we didn't go back to the house. We just booked our flight, and then off to the coast we went.
My dear, to wait.
Yeah, to wait. So between, by the time we get from the coast, we took a route to Benduk, and then we pick up our car, and then we have to come to the finished house.
Hello. Shafo Mashenjo.
Oh.
Shafo Aro Mashenjo.
I was tired. And ever since that, I think to a certain extent, when it's all said and done, I like using the word.
Mm-hmm.
I think this show, it's a statement on its own that this is the therapy you didn't pay for.
Yeah.
And then you got it for free.
For free.
I was like, thin.
How can you eat people's things, people's breads? Your child is being given you also.
Living you learn.
You live and you learn to die tomorrow, my dear.
So, like, the whole perception of it is like, you know, the things that I learned growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm teaching my kids now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm teaching everybody out there, which I know this is how things should be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, show gratitude.
Yeah.
Tell people that you love, that you love them, because tomorrow is not guaranteed.
My dear. And that was a thought that I had last night, you know. Last night when I got home, I was emotional.
Mm.
And I was thinking that, in all honesty, you know, me, Elizabeth, right now, If I die, where are my children going to go? Like, literally, who is going to take care of these children? If it is a tomorrow activity, where do I go? I wept so hard. I think that that's why I have a headache, because it was such an emotional conversation for me, because I realized many things, man. I realized that, oh shit, in it, I don't know.
But I think in one way is more, in more ways than one.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are the same.
Yeah.
I'm the kind of person that sends my kids away so that they can have a great time without me.
Yeah.
I'll be like, no, go, and then experience.
I'll be the ATM.
Yeah.
I'll be the ATM. Mm-hmm.
And like a friend, my kids grow up, my child, my firstborn grow up with this child, a childhood friend. They were born the same year.
Mm-hmm.
They go to the same school. They do everything together.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's like her sister.
Me and the mother are solid friends.
Mm-hmm.
This is the person you call, which I know, listen, I'm not feeling well, I need this. And then she'll be like, okay, you are asking for a 2-liter Coke. I can only give you 500.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, like, over the years, this friend has been there.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I say, I need your child.
Mm-hmm.
Your child are going over to the holiday somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have a problem.
Yeah.
Like, where are they going? Like, they are just going somewhere safe because they did well.
Yeah.
And then she was like, God, I'm like, yeah, don't worry about anything. They are all sorted.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was like, God, okay.
Bye. Pakeli ni mbe yewe vachote iko swa kopo. Vati.
Yeah. So, like, when it's school holidays or the out weekend, I just go and then pick up the kids. By the time she was like, how did you get here? Like, it was uncle that brought us this.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Good. So, like, do you need petrol? Do you need what? No, there's no questions like that.
When I need, I'll tell you.
Yeah, because when tomorrow I'm not here,
mm-hmm.
because there was this other day when you say when tomorrow starts without me,
mm-hmm. and I'm not there to dry your eyes.
Yeah, must be content with the idea that when I was here, mm-hmm. I did what I could.
Yeah,
and you should be okay with that.
Yeah,
and then people will look back and they will be like, we were loved right.
We were loved right. They will know what love is.
Yeah.
Yeah. They will know what love is.
At her age,
mm-hmm.
my father, my mom and my dad were gone already.
Already. It was just you and your knees.
Oh, the only love I know is from the people outside. Those people outside just shipped me off to a boarding school. And then when you come back, like, there's just little, so much they could do. But by the time they could do anything, the holiday is over. And then you have to go back. You have to be the child, the parent, the mother, the father, the responsible, all at once. And then you'll be like,
a disciplinarian.
So now, the things that I learned, at the later stage in life, I'm teaching them at the lower stage.
Yeah. So that they know.
They don't make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
The kind that we did.
That's true. All right, my friend Otuafo, I think I will.
You go see a doctor.
I will tomorrow. I will.
We need you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you so much.
You mean the world to some of us.
Oh.
Even though we don't know each other personally.
Mm-hmm.
Forever and a day.
Forever and a day, and you can send money on my birthday. Thank you. Bye.
When is your birthday anyway?
October, don't worry. I usually announce it 3 months in advance.
Okay, cool.
All right.
No problem.
Ciao, ciao.
Bye.
All right, beloveds, I bid you guys farewell. Bye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? Even a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.